There's a lot of it going around.
Yeah.
We'll call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. Members, we obviously are starting late, and we have a long agenda. That is a long presentation that is about to begin. The Heritage Finance Division was scheduled to meet in this room at 4 o'clock, but they have graciously agreed to move to a different room, so we will not be up against the 4 o'clock deadline. And what I would like to do is have our testifier do his presentation and allow for questions, and then the plan would be to recess and reconvene at 6 o'clock.
Chair, can I
Representative Norris?
Can I ask where Heritage is moving to?
Mr. Pomeroy, do you know?
I believe 500 North.
I serve on both committees. So. Okay.
Anyway, that is the plan. I believe we do have a quorum present at this time. Representative Slocum, if you would be so kind as to move approval of the minutes from March 14th.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes from March 14th? Representative Coons.
The date on Monday, February 12th should actually be Wednesday, March 12th.
Thank you very much. We will see that that correction is made. Are there any other corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of their approval, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Minutes are adopted. Members, it is really my privilege to introduce our testifier today. Before I do that, the reason that he is here to testify is on House File 995, the so-called peak oil resolution. And I would move House File 995 to be before us for consideration. David Hughes, from whom we will hear in a moment, is a geologist and scientist with 35 years of experience studying the energy resources of Canada for the Geological Survey of Canada and also for the private sector. He's the leader of the National Coal Inventory, which is a digital knowledge base on coal used to determine the availability of resources for conventional and non-conventional uses, including coal bed methane production and the sequestration of carbon dioxide. He's also a team leader for unconventional gas for the Canadian Gas Potential Committee, an organization which publishes Canada's most authoritative assessments of natural gas potential. His evolving analysis of global and North American energy issues has been presented across Canada, the United States, and internationally, federal, state, provincial, and municipal agencies, to industry groups, and to the general public. Aspects of his analysis have also been taken up by the popular press and trade journals, including the Toronto Star, Canadian Business Magazine, Canadian Press Wire Service, global public media, and innumerable internet sites. I first became aware of Mr. Hughes' work after the Association for the Study of Peak Oil Conference in Boston in 2006, and had the privilege of hearing his presentation at the same conference in Houston in 2007. I think that his analysis of global fossil fuel availability is something that we all find extremely valuable. And Mr. Hughes, welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record, and please proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here to provide testimony on the resolution to provide a response plan for the preparation for peak oil. I can say at the outset that awareness is the first step for action. This resolution is extremely important in addressing the awareness issue and beginning the crucial steps to provide a rational response to what will certainly be a society-defining transition in our use of energy. I hope I can provide some additional insights this afternoon to underscore the importance and the urgency of this resolution. Now, I know Matt Simmons was here a little over a month ago and really gave you a lot of facts and figures on the recent history of oil production. What I'd like to do is look at the whole energy system. It's not necessarily just the peak oil problem. It's an energy system problem. And I'd like to look at it in the context of decades and even centuries just to see where we're at today.
Mr. Hughes, if I could interrupt you for just a moment. Actually, members of the audience, Mr. Hughes suggested to me earlier, and I neglected to mention it since this is a PowerPoint presentation that is visible on the screens. If those members of the audience that are seated in the back would find it useful to move closer to the screens, I think you might find it helpful. So if you want to just take a moment to orient yourself to one of the screens, if you aren't well situated at the moment, we'll pause to let you do that.
Yeah, I would certainly second that motion. There's a lot of graphics here.
Well, everyone seems to be happy where they are, Mr. Hughes, so please proceed.
Okay. I think Al Gore, with The Inconvenient Truth, has got the issue of climate change on a lot of people's radar. Most people know about climate change. There's two issues facing the human race, as I see it. Climate change, which is likely happening and will continue to happen, irregardless of what we do about carbon emissions, we're in the midst of climate change. And there's what I call the energy sustainability dilemma. The energy sustainability dilemma is much less known. Most people are not aware of it at all. I'd say that penetration in the general public is probably less than 2% of the population. However, in my view, it's the biggest elephant in the room in terms of short-term socioeconomic impact to our way of life. So I'd like to define the energy sustainability dilemma. What is it? I'd like to define it by looking at history, what's actually happened. It's difficult to argue with history. It's easy to argue with forecasts of the future, and there's many forecasts on energy that come out of agencies like the EIA and the IEA and so forth. I'd like to look at the availability and deliverability of non-renewable fuels, oil, gas, coal, and uranium. And these are really the energy-dense elixirs of our modern society. I'd like to look at electricity, some issues in keeping the lights on, implications of population growth, and even more importantly, aspirations for future growth and consumption of energy. And I'd like to look at how we go forward in a finite world. These are non-renewable resources, and at some point, they have limits. If we look at history, there's some very good data on consumption of fuel by region, by fuel type, out of the BP Statistical Review of World Energy that's published every year in June. And it goes back to 1965. And this is the last four decades of consumption of energy. We can see that energy consumption nearly tripled globally. Huge growth in the Asia-Pacific region, China, India, Australia, lesser growth in North America and Europe because their consumption levels are already very high. If you look at growth by fuel, natural gas was the fastest growing fuel source over this period, followed by oil, coal, hydroelectricity, and nuclear. If we look at forecasts for growth in energy consumption, this is out of the EIA. The reference case forecast is a 50% growth in consumption globally by 2030. If we look at growth in consumption by economic development, we can see that the OECD countries, the industrialized world, consumes 54% of the world's oil energy, but it comprises only 18% of the world's population. The developing world is forecast to double in energy consumption through 2030, when the developing world will be consuming more energy than the industrialized world. Consumption growth by fuel, coal, is forecast to be the fastest growing fuel source through 2030, followed by natural gas and oil. Hydro and true renewables, large hydro and things like windmills and biomass and so forth, will also grow significantly, as will nuclear. I usually say, if you only remember two slides in this presentation, remember this one and the next one. This is world per capita consumption by fuel. We can see that back in 1850, 90% of the world's energy was provided by wood, about 10% by coal. In 2006, 11% was provided by wood, hydro, windmills, biomass, PV, all of the other renewable sources. 89% was provided by coal, oil, gas, and uranium. So 89% non-renewable. If we look at things like population growth compared to per capita consumption and total consumption of energy, we can see that there's five times as many people as in the world in 1850. Each person is consuming eight times as much energy. The world as a whole is consuming 43 times as much energy as in 1850, 89% non-renewable. And all of these non-renewable fuel sources will likely peak sometime in the first half of the century. That is the energy sustainability dilemma defined. If you look at the U.S., this is total production and consumption of energy in the U.S. You can see that production of all forms of energy peaked in 1998. Meanwhile, consumption has continued to grow through that period. So more and more energy is being imported into the U.S. as we go forward. So just to summarize, hydrocarbons, 88% of the world's primary energy in 2006. Moving forward, that's not forecast to change out until 2030 or beyond. Most of the balance of energy supply is provided by large hydro and nuclear sources with their own environmental problems. And the question is this sustainable in the long term? I'd like to focus in more detail at oil, gas, and coal. There's nothing quite like oil, number one source of energy in the world. Nearly 36% of the world's primary energy consumption in 2006. The ultimate fuel for international trade. It's easy to move oil around the world by tanker and pipeline. The Achilles heel of oil is geopolitics. Three quarters of what's left of the world's oil is in the OPEC cartel. all of the world's spare capacity is in Saudi Arabia, and there's a very tight balance between supply and demand, which is why we saw $112 barrel oil yesterday. It's down a bit thanks to the collapse of Bear Stearns today. Alternatives to oil have seen similar price spikes over the last decade. Natural gas, triple, coal triple. Uranium is up by an order of magnitude since 2000. A very compelling chart for me, this is cumulative consumption of oil by the human race from the time we started using it till year-end 2006. As of year-end 2006, we consumed about 1.1 trillion barrels of oil. That's somewhere between half and a third of all the oil that humans will ever consume. We think the first oil well was in Canada, in southwestern Ontario, drilled in 1859, a couple weeks before Titusville in Pennsylvania. If we look at the cumulative rate of consumption of oil, however, we can see that 90% of that oil has been consumed since 1958, half of it since 1984, and 10% since 2002. So we're in a radical uphill spiral in our consumption of oil. If we look at production and consumption of oil by geopolitics, we can see that the non-OPEC world outside of the former Soviet Union peaked in 2002. The only growth in non-OPEC production is in the former Soviet Union. OPEC produced about 44% of the world's oil in 2006 and consumed only 11% of it. However, the demographics in OPEC countries are very young. Their domestic consumption of oil is going up quite quickly at the expense of their ability to export oil to other countries. Non-OPEC outside of the former Soviet Union produced 41% of the world's oil, but consumed 84% of it. So we're highly dependent on imports of oil. Reference case forecast for growth in oil consumption to 2030 is a 42% increase. Where are the world's remaining oil reserves? This is reported oil reserves from 1980 to 2006. As of 2006, three-quarters of the world's oil was in OPEC countries. Only about 13% in non-OPEC outside of the former Soviet Union, and 11% in the former Soviet Union. If we look a little closer at reported oil reserves in OPEC countries, we can see that back in the late 80s, their reported oil reserves ramped up very significantly. And this was the time they changed the way they set their production quotas. They set their quotas based on reported reserves. And lo and behold, their reported reserves increased by nearly 300 billion barrels without significant new discoveries of oil. Over this 26-year period, OPEC's reported resources went up by 113%. They also produced nearly 200 billion barrels of oil over that period. And many experienced geologists would say a lot of those reported reserves are political, not geological. We really don't have a lot of data about what's reported in OPEC countries. How long would world oil reserves last at current production rates? If we believe the OPEC reserve numbers, they have about 70 years of remaining reserves. Non-OPEC, 13, former Soviet Union, 30. The world as a whole, about 40 years of remaining oil. A chart from Colin Campbell, a very compelling chart for me. The green is the amount of oil discovered in each year. The black line is the amount of oil produced. World oil discoveries peaked in 1965. And since about 1984, the world has been producing more oil than it's been discovering. We're now consuming 3 to 4 barrels of oil for every barrel that we're finding. So we're basically eating into the oil bank account of previous discoveries. World oil production peak oil, it's been talked about more and more lately. When will that happen? It's debatable because of the variables, but it's highly likely to happen. It's only a question of when. It depends on ultimate recoverable reserves, a function of how much is there, technology and price, so-called reserve growth as we find out more about producing pools. And it's dependent on rate of consumption, which is also a function of price, infrastructure, and depletion rates. A lot of peaking has happened in the world already. This is all of the countries, the oil-producing countries in the world that have peaked, arranged in chronological order, but by the time that they peaked. And this is the percentage that they're producing below peak. The U.S. was first. The U.S. peaked in 1970. It's now producing at about 40% below peak. these red countries are OPEC countries. It turns out that half of OPEC is past peak. Iraq, for example, peaked in 1978. Indonesia, 1977. Iran peaked in 1974. Countries in the North Sea sector, like the UK, peaked in 1999. It's now 44% below peak. Norway, 2001. Denmark, 2004. But the interesting thing is, 22 countries have peaked since 1996, 17 since 2000. So as we move forward, the rate of peaking of countries is accelerating. Two-thirds of the world's oil in 2006 was produced from countries that are producing past peak. There's many forecasts of when world oil will peak. This is one of them by Colin Campbell. And Campbell is suggesting a peak at about 87.5 million barrels per day in 2010. Put that in perspective, the world is at about 85 million barrels per day at present, so we're very close to Colin Campbell's peak. Surplus capacity in the world. Normally we've had about 10% surplus capacity back in 2002, for example. In 2007 we had a little over 2.5 million barrels per day of surplus capacity. That's about 3% of the world oil market, and that's why we're seeing the volatility in oil prices. How much oil is ultimately recoverable in the world? Prior to the U.S. Geological Survey assessment in 2000, the conventional thinking was about 2 trillion barrels. We've consumed 1.1 of those. The USGS came out with a new assessment in 2000, and their median number was 3 trillion barrels, a trillion barrels more than most previous assessments. The EIA took that 3 trillion barrel number and said, when will world oil peak? Conventional wisdom would say it'll peak when we've consumed about half. That would be 2018, if there's really 3 trillion barrels recoverable. The EIA suggested we could keep growing world oil production until we hit a 10-year reserve to production ratio, 82% ultimate recovered consumed. And that's what they based their forecast on, that you can download off their website. Doing that removes the peak about 20 years into the future, to the 2040 timeframe. And this is what the EIA's forecast looks like. You can download it off their website. They're suggesting a smooth growth in oil production to 118 million barrels per day in 2030. Most geologists that really have looked at this would say we'll never get past 90 million barrels a day, and that'll probably occur in the 2010 timeframe. I'd just like to point out unconventional oil on the left-hand chart. If we quadruple unconventional oil, that's things like the tar sands, Venezuela, extra heavy oil, biofuels, coal to liquids, all of it. It's relatively insignificant compared to forecast world demand. So the message there is non-conventional oil cannot offset declines in conventional oil. This is what peaking looks like. These are giant and supergiant fields that have peaked in the past. Typically, a bell-shaped peak with a very long tail. All of these fields peaked before 50% of ultimate recoverable oil was consumed. So I would suggest the EIA scenario that world oil production can grow till we've consumed 82% is wishful thinking indeed. Actual global oil supply data, this is the last 7 years of global oil supply. We can see the world has been on a plateau since the fourth quarter of 2004. The world had a peak to date of all liquids in September 2006. OPEC had a peak to date in September 2005. Agencies like the IEA would suggest it's just a matter of investment. If we invest enough money in upstream oil and gas, we can reverse these declines, and that remains to be seen going forward. We may already be at peak oil, and people like Matt Simmons are convinced that we are. 20 estimates of the timing of peak oil, these have been published in a report commissioned by the U.S. DOE in 2007. The median estimate is 2014, if you just average all these estimates. If you take out the outliers, the EIA in 2040 and CIRA in 2030, the median peak is in 2012, and that's tomorrow from the standpoint of mitigating peak oil. President Bush said America is addicted to oil in his State of the Union address two or three years ago. Nothing could be truer. The U.S. imports about two-thirds of its oil. It peaked in 1970. Canada became a net exporter of oil back in the early 80s, thanks to growth in the oil sands. Mexico has grown its oil production and consumption radically since 1965. However, Mexican oil production peaked in 2004, and it is now falling quite quickly. Mexico is the number two oil supplier to the U.S. Reserve to production ratio for North American oil. The U.S., 12 years. Canada, including oil sands under active development, 15. Mexico, 10. North America as a whole, about 12 years of remaining oil. Canadian oil production. We talk about the Canadian energy superpower and being the number one exporter to the U.S. We don't talk about imports of oil into Canada. And Eastern Canada is almost totally dependent on imports purchased on the world market. Roughly 43% of our production is now oil sands, synthetic crude and bitumen. So if you subtract imports from exports, Canada is a relatively insignificant net exporter of oil, less than 1 million barrels per day. New energy scenarios for Canada were published back in November. Their reference case oil price forecast for 2030 was $50 a barrel. Obviously, they don't believe in peak oil. Many other analysts would say this is dead wrong. Jeff Rubin is projecting $150 oil in 2012. Charles Maxwell, very well-known analyst, is projecting $180 oil in 2015 and $300 oil in 2020. Conventional oil production in Canada has peaked. We're really hoping we're going to find another billion barrels off the East Coast. It hasn't been found yet. And this right-hand projection assumes that it will be found and produced before 2020. Canada is big on talking about the oil sands, being the number two reserve holder, second only to Saudi Arabia in the world. The oil sands are very different from conventional oil, however. They take a lot of infrastructure, capital, and time to grow production. They take a lot of natural gas. Natural gas is being used as a source of energy to refine the oil sands. So expansion is obviously limited by gas supply and price. It's also limited by water supply. It takes 1 to 2 barrels of water to produce a barrel of synthetic crude. Bitumen export capacity, and there's a lot of talk about exporting bitumen from Canada and refining it in the U.S., is limited by diluent. You really have to mix it with about a 50-50 blend of light oil to get it to move through a pipeline. Total oil production in Canada, including the oil sands, so this is bitumen and upgraded oil. Very aggressive growth scenario in this right-hand case, 4.9 million barrels per day by 2030. If we do that, Canada could supply as much as 4.8% of global oil production. So very significant for Canada, but a drop in the bucket compared to what the world is expected to need by that point in time. I just point out surface mineable oil sands are the least energy intensive, but they only comprise about 20% of the total resource. And if these projections are correct, all surface mineable oil sands will be completely mined out by 2041. So even though the oil sands are abundant, they're not forever at these consumption rates. Non-conventional oil, this is the EIA's reference case, growing them by nearly 4 times by 2030. And this includes things like biofuels, oil sands, Venezuela, heavy oil, coal to liquids, gas to liquids, all of it could be as much as 8.9% of forecast world consumption. So we're not going to get out of this by going to things like biofuels and more unconventional oil. The energy return on investment is a very important concept. How much energy do we get back from the energy that we spend to get oil? And back in the good old days in Saudi Arabia, the energy profit ratio was 100-1. New conventional oil, horizontal wells, deep water oil, much lower energy return on investment, but it's still about 25-1. Things like oil sands, the in-situ oil sands is about 4-1. So we burn a barrel to get 3 barrels of oil. The mining is a little better. Corn-based ethanol, depending on who you talk to, is either energy negative or very modestly energy positive, about 30%. Biodiesel is a bit better than that. Shale oil, in my mind, is energy negative. Nobody's produced oil from shale oil at an energy profit, to my knowledge. So this is what I like to show people. The black is the portion of an in-situ resource that can be returned at an energy profit. The red is energy negative. Things like oil shales have very large reported in-situ resources. The proportion that can be extracted at an energy profit is very low. Oil sands are the same. 2 trillion barrels in-situ, maybe 174 billion recoverable. So the issue is not really a resource issue. It's a deliverability issue. How fast can these resources be converted into supply to meet world oil consumption? And that's really the crux of the matter. Natural gas, third largest source of energy in the world after oil and coal. Largely landlocked when it comes to international trade, it's difficult to move gas around the world compared to oil. Only about 7% of world gas consumption was moved as liquefied natural gas in 2006. It's difficult to store by comparison to oil and coal. There's about 3.4 trillion cubic feet of gas storage in the U.S. that has to be filled to make it through the winter. LNG is not a greenhouse gas friendly way to move gas around the world. We need to burn about 15-30% of it just to get it here in the liquefaction, transportation, and regasification process. So you need to look at full cycle emissions, not just burner tip emissions, when you consider LNG. LNG is subject to geopolitics. Three quarters of what's left of the world's gas is located in the former Soviet Union and the Middle East. So there's geopolitical issues to LNG. We got started consuming natural gas a bit later than oil, 1885. But it's interesting to note that 90% of all the natural gas consumed by the human race has been consumed since 1963, half of it since 1988, 10% of it since 2003. So we're on the same uphill spiral of consumption with natural gas as we are with oil. World oil production and consumption of gas, 1970 to 2006, we can see that North America produces and consumes about a third of the world's gas. And production and consumption is much more balanced than with oil because of the difficulty of moving natural gas between continents. EIA's reference case forecast for consumption of gas by 2030 is up 65%. World gas reserves. The good news is there's lots of gas in the world. The bad news is it's not in North America. Only about 4% of the world's remaining gas is in North America. Three quarters of it, as I said, is in the Middle East in the former Soviet Union. World natural gas reserve to production ratio in years. North America, about 10 years. Europe, 20. The world as a whole, about 60 years of remaining gas. And the world outside of Europe and North America, about 100 years of remaining gas, much of which is stranded. There's no infrastructure to move it to market. Natural gas production peak. This is Colin Campbell's global projection of peak gas. He's suggesting 2045. If we convert natural gas to its energy equivalent, we can see that natural gas doesn't have enough energy in it to offset the energy declines in oil after peak oil. Campbell is suggesting a total oil and gas peak in 2010. North American gas production and movements. Canada, in its infinite wisdom, had a national energy program which was canceled in the mid-80s. Canada's gas production took off. It grew by as much as 10% per year until it hit a plateau in 2001, 2002. We exported half of our gas to the U.S. in 2006. So Canada's the number one contributor to imports of gas into the U.S. The balance is LNG. North American natural gas reserve to production ratios, how long will it last at present production rates? And it turns out the only major gas producing country in the world that has a lower reserve to production ratio than the U.S. is Canada. Canada has about 9 years, the U.S. 11, Mexico 9, North America as a whole about 10 years of remaining gas. Mexico is a net importer of gas from the U.S. and will continue to be for the foreseeable future. Canadian discovered and undiscovered gas resources. It turns out that what we've discovered in Canada, that of what we've discovered, we've consumed about 53%. We have 9.4 years of proven reserves, 4.9 years of possible resources. Of what's left of Canadian gas, 77% of it hasn't been found yet. We think it's there because of the statistical analyses, and we certainly hope it is. And this is what's happening in Canada. Alberta is about 80% of Canadian gas production. And the initial productivity of the gas wells when we first hooked them up to the system has declined by 72% since 1996. So we need four gas wells in 2005 to equal the production of one gas well in 1996. And that's what I call the exploration treadmill. Back in 96, we drilled 4,000 successful gas wells. In 2006, we drilled 16,000 successful gas wells. We grew production by about 10% by quadrupling the amount of drilling until we hit a production plateau in 2001-2002. We're still about at that plateau, and we didn't find enough of that undiscovered gas in most of the previous 11 years to replace consumption. This is what Canadian marketable natural gas production looks like. You can see the huge growth through the 90s till we hit the production plateau in 2001-2002. Production fell, it grew again with record drilling. Drilling's falling off, and we're just beginning to see the declines in Canadian gas production. This is another expression of the treadmill. The amount of gas we've added per foot drilled is down over 50% since 1999. Meanwhile, the cost of drilling a foot has doubled since 1999. So back in the early part of this decade, we could make a dollar at a $3 gas. We could get a 10% rate of return. We now need $8 gas to get a 10% rate of return. Gas has been languishing in price for most of this winter. It's a little higher now. And that's caused a rapid fall off in rig count in Canada. The rig count is down by nearly 50% since early 2006. And we're just beginning to see the fall off in Canadian production because of the lack of drilling. The National Energy Board's forecast, short-term forecast for Canadian gas production, the reference case is down about 4% per year through 2010. Even given those statistics, which in my mind are quite daunting, the National Energy Board is forecasting $7 gas in 2030. so they don't believe in the data. We had $10 gas a couple weeks ago in North America. Japan, I'll note, is paying $19 for LNG imports at this present time. The National Energy Board's forecast through 2030 for Canadian conventional gas, they recognize a very steep and prolonged decline. We're hoping for new discoveries off the East Coast. We're also hoping for the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline to get built in two of these scenarios. The Mackenzie Valley Pipeline has gone from $5 billion to $16.2 billion in the last 3 years, so it's a question mark whether it will be built.
Mr. Hughes, to this point, the representative has a question.
I do. Mr. Hughes, I might have missed it in your opening remarks. Fortified islands in your third graph to the right. What does that mean again?
Mr. Hughes?
I'll just go through them all. Triple D, the world is a very pacifistic place. Global trade is not impeded. The economies are functioning smoothly. Continuing trends is a business as usual case forecast. Fortified islands as everything goes wrong. Geopolitics locks up overseas supplies. And we're more and more dependent on domestic North American energy production.
Great, thank you.
This is their forecast of unconventional gas, things like coal bed methane, shale gas, very bullish in the Fortified Islands case. The previous estimate of 4% per year decline I just showed you was published in October, and that's the star. These estimates were published in November, so they assumed that the geology healed itself quite a bit, just over a one-month period. And I would suggest that that could be overly optimistic in terms of the long-term projection. LNG, imported gas to North America. Over half of Canada's gas will be imported in this scenario, 20% in the reference case and a little bit in the Fortified Islands case. Canadian domestic consumption of gas, the business as usual projection is a 45% growth in consumption through 2030. This is what's actually happening in the U.S. in terms of consumption of gas. Peak consumption happened in 2000. We had a contraction of consumption in all sectors except for electricity. A lot of demand destruction in the industrial sector, things like petrochemicals, plastics. Those industries were shut down and moved offshore to where gas is cheaper. A huge growth in gas consumption for electricity. And that's because of all of the capacity expansion that happened over the last decade in natural gas fire generation in North America. The EIA, their supply demand forecast for the U.S., huge growth in imports of LNG. They recognize that Canadian imports are likely to decline. The Alaska pipeline gets built in 2020. They're counting on growth in lower 48 gas production, 8.4% by 2016. But it's interesting that the EIA even is getting much more pessimistic about U.S. gas. A peak supply in 2016 and only a 7.2% overall growth in consumption over this period. Their projection last year was a 19% growth in consumption. So they're getting a bit more real, even though they're still quite optimistic. How realistic is it to be able to grow consumption in the lower 48, or grow production in the lower 48? Not very, in my thinking. The U.S. is on the same gas exploration treadmill that Canada's on. They tripled the number of successful gas wells drilled since 1999. However, production peaked in mid-2001. How much drilling they'll have to do to get up to the 2016 forecast of the EIA is a lot, and I'm not sure that it actually could happen. Best case scenario, reference case, Canadian production scenarios for gas, and reference case EIA production scenarios. Canada will have no exports for the U.S. by 2028, and we won't be able to meet our own domestic demands by about that same time frame. The best case scenario for the EIA supply-demand forecast, the U.S. has to import 16% of its gas by 2030. U.S. dry gas production, this is a month-by-month smooth-moving average. We can see the peak in 2001. Katrina took a lot of gas production offline, which is more or less back. But U.S. gas production is down about 4.3% since it peaked. So it's falling at about 1% per year on average. Going forward, if U.S. declines in lower 48 production, start off at 1% per year, and grow to 3% per year over the period, which is quite likely, the U.S. will be short 42% of its gas supply by 2030. That means about 10 trillion cubic feet of gas that would have to be brought in as LNG. If you believe the forecast, the implications are that there's likely to be serious shortfalls in continental gas supply coming. Canada is clearly unlikely to be able to fill that supply gap. Solutions involve a portfolio of scenarios. Number one, don't use it, conservation and efficiency. To me, that's the number one solution that we should be looking at. LNG, bring it in from offshore. More unconventional gas, fuel switching to oil and coal. Capacity is almost non-existent to do that without more capital investment in new plants. Destroy demand, a shutdown, petrochemical and fertilizer industries and move them offshore to where gas is more abundant. LNG, said to be competitive with conventional gas production at about $4 an MCF. The U.S. paid as much as $10 an MCF for LNG in 2006. Production and consumption of LNG. Japan is the number one consumer of LNG in the world, followed by South Korea, Europe. U.S. is number four. Many countries are counting on LNG as a solution for their gas supply problems, in particular countries like China and India and Europe. Most of U.S. LNG came from Trinidad Tobago in 2006. If we had to bring 10 TCF into the U.S., what would that take in terms of LNG infrastructure? We'd need to triple the world's LNG infrastructure, which would be 200 new tankers, 30 new regasification terminals in North America, 56 new foreign-based liquefaction trains, capital expenditure somewhere upwards of $200 billion U.S., time to build 10 to 20 years, overcoming the NIMBY syndrome in locating new terminals, and that's been a huge problem in the U.S., accepting the geopolitical implications of a dependency on offshore supply sources. So not only are we depending on offshore sources for oil, now it's natural gas, petrochemicals, fertilizers, plastics, and so forth. FERC updates this map of proposed LNG terminals pretty much once a month. This is the August version. There's 44 proposed terminals on this map. There's 5 existing terminals in North America at this point in time. I keep a running tally of canceled terminals. There's 26 of them on my list in the last 4 years. And most of that's because of NIMBY. And I would suggest maybe 10 of these terminals will actually get built over the next couple decades. It turns out that the big issue with LNG is supply of LNG, not supply of regasification terminals. The big problem is LNG is becoming a spot market. Countries like Japan are willing to pay double or more the price that LNG would fetch in North America. So there's going to be a lot of competition for LNG going forward. The energy return on energy investment for natural gas is every bit as important as for oil. And it's the same relationship, very high energy payback with early discoveries. Things like coal bed methane have a very much lower energy payback. Shale gas is even worse, so we're spending more and more energy just to net out energy going forward. Gas hydrates, some of you may have heard about gas hydrates. Huge in situ resources, but nobody's ever produced them at an energy profit at this point. So it's the same situation as with oil. It's not a resource issue. It's a deliverability issue. It's how fast can we convert those resources to supply. Coal, number two in the world, second only to oil in terms of energy consumption. 28% of the world's primary consumption of energy in 2006. Used for electricity generation more so than any other fuel. Lowest cost heat source. Coal is the cheapest heat source in the world. But of course, the Achilles heel of coal is its carbon footprint. It's double the carbon footprint of natural gas. We can do a lot better with coal if we use it intelligently with the best technologies, and I'll talk a bit about that later. Number one fastest growing hydrocarbon fuel source in the world. Consumption of coal has grown by nearly 30% since 2001 worldwide. We got started with the consumption of coal a lot earlier than oil and gas. People talk about coal being a 19th century fuel. In fact, it was a 20th century fuel. 90% of all the coal consumed by humans has been consumed since 1909, half of it since 1970, and 10% since 2000. Production and consumption of coal. A lot of the growth in consumption of coal globally has been in China and India. The Asia-Pacific region has increased its production and consumption hugely over the past two decades. North America is also a huge producer and consumer of coal. Reference case forecast for coal consumption, 74% growth through 2030. If we convert hydrocarbons to their energy equivalent, we can see that coal is quite evenly distributed around the world, with the notable exception of the Middle East. The Middle East has a lot of the world's oil and gas, but not much of the world's coal. Asia-Pacific, Saudi Arabia, coal, as is North America. 90% of what's left of North America's energy is coal. On a heat basis, coal is the cheapest energy source. Export thermal coal is about half the price of oil or of gas and about a quarter the price of oil on a heat basis. Some of the mine mouths, power plants in the U.S. and in Alberta are amongst the cheapest fuel source on the planet. U.S. production of coal, or North American coal production actually, in energy terms peaked in 1998. In tonnage terms, it hasn't peaked yet. And that's because the Appalachian high heat content coal is declining, and the low heat content coal of the Powder River Basin and others is growing. Peak coal, there's been several studies that have come out in 2007 on global coal production. This is Energy Watch Group. People thought of coal as an energy source for hundreds or thousands of years. In fact, Energy Watch Group suggested there's not nearly enough as much recoverable coal in the world as has been previously thought. They suggested a global peak in coal production as soon as 2025, and a peak in Chinese coal production could come as early as 2020. That was the first study. Here's another study out of Caltech. It said basically the same thing. World recoverable coal resources are overstated by a factor of two. And they used what are called the Hubbert linearization growth plots. And basically, you plot the annual change in cumulative production, and when it gets to zero, all the coal has been recovered. And Caltech did these plots for all of the coal-producing regions of the world and came up with the conclusion that global coal resources are overstated by 100%, which was a stunning conclusion. They did the same thing for oil and gas, and they said, well, how much coal is remaining? We burned about 1.2 trillion barrels oil equivalent. There's 1.6 trillion barrels oil equivalent remaining, so we're not quite through half of the world's coal. In terms of all hydrocarbons, oil, gas, and coal, they felt we consumed close to 3 trillion barrels oil equivalent, and we've got another 4.7 trillion barrels oil equivalent to recover. If we burn all of that carbon as fast as we can, as fast as we can get it out of the ground, 90% of it will be gone by 2076. They looked at two scenarios, and they compared it to the IPCC carbon in the atmosphere scenarios. Their production constrained projection, which is burn it as fast as we can get it out of the ground, couldn't get enough carbon into the atmosphere to get to the lowest IPCC production scenario. And what that tells you is, of the two dilemmas, the energy sustainability dilemma is likely the nearest term problem and should be getting our undivided immediate attention. They looked at both carbon in the atmosphere and CO2 limits, production constrained and rate constrained. So they said, what if we had a super Kyoto rate constraint into how fast we burn this stuff? In their production constraint, just about all of that carbon's gone by 2100. In the rate constrained, it's gone by 2200. We can get to a little over 450 ppm of CO2 in the atmosphere, which is right at Hansen's danger threshold for CO2, but it's nowhere near his hysterical climate change impact scenario. Electricity. Reliable electricity defines a first world country. Electricity cannot be stored in bulk. It has to be generated on demand. We convert hydrocarbons to electricity at an energy penalty of 30 to 70% depending on technology and fuel. Electricity is a regional commodity because of transmission losses. It's not a continental commodity or a world tradable commodity. Projections in electricity generation for the world, China triple, India almost triple, the rest of the developing world more than double, the industrialized world up by 40%. So the developing world will be generating more than half of the world's electricity by 2030 in this projection. Generation by fuel, coal, the most important fuel source for electricity generation worldwide, more than double by 2030, increasing its total market share. Natural gas, more than double. Nuclear, in fact, although nuclear is projected to increase in real terms, it loses market share going forward. Increasing nuclear, as I'll tell you in a couple of minutes, implies a massive construction program on nuclear energy, because a lot of our plants are getting old and have to be repowered or replaced. Hydro and true renewables in this scenario grow in real terms but lose market share globally going forward. Generation in the U.S. by fuel. The U.S. is counting on coal big time going forward. In this scenario, coal is 57% of U.S. generation by 2030. Real growth in nuclear, but nuclear loses market share. Real growth in hydro and true renewables, but a relatively small part of the total market share in 2030. The EIA recognizes the problems with gas supply, and natural gas is projected to lose market share going forward. Why do people build gas-fired generation? For one thing, it's relatively cheap compared to coal, nuclear, or hydro. The capital cost is low. It's a proven technology. It's an off-the-shelf technology. And it can be implemented quite quickly compared to coal, nuclear, or hydro. The Achilles heel of gas is its fuel cost, which is very high and volatile compared to the other sources. North American generation capacity expansion. Over the last decade, it's been more than 90% gas, with a complete disregard to the natural gas supply issue. Going forward, there'll be a lot more wind, nuclear, hydro and true renewables, gas and coal. What about clean coal? Some people say clean coal is an oxymoron. How clean is clean coal? Well, the best technologies to burn coal are about 25% more efficient than most existing coal plants. So the best technologies can get us a 25% reduction of CO2 emissions. And that's really ultra supercritical compared to old coal. Denmark is a world leader in wind, but it's also a world leader in coal. Denmark uses ultra supercritical plants in industrial locations where they can actually capture and use the district heat. And if you can do that, you can take a coal plant from 34% efficiency at present to 70% efficiency. So you can reduce the CO2 emissions and the fuel cost by about 50%. Just by being smart about how you use the coal. Obviously, if we continue to use coal, we have to do so using the best technologies to minimize emissions. Carbon capture and storage, it's been talked about a lot as a solution to climate change. I'd say let's do the math in an energy and money constrained world. And I just did a comparison. Take the best technology, ultra supercritical at 44%. Combine it with heat capture to take it to 70% efficient overall. So the CO2 reduction with the best technologies and district heat capture is about 51% compared to old coal technologies. If we go to carbon capture and storage, we take an IGCC plant at 38.4% efficient. We fit it with carbon capture and storage. We lose about 23% of the energy, so we knock that plant down to about 31% efficiency. We can get rid of 85% of the CO2, however, but it costs us 39% more to build a plant. That plant will require 124% more coal for its lifetime. And I haven't counted the CO2 emissions in mining and transporting that coal or the capital cost of buying that coal. We also have the administrative overhead of the complexity of the equipment to capture and store the carbon, the CO2 pipeline, the injection wells, the monitoring of the whole operation for decades or centuries. So there's a lot of issues with carbon capture and storage that really have to be looked at objectively. What about nuclear? As I mentioned, a lot of nuclear was commissioned back in the 70s and 80s in the red. And because of retirements and decommissioning of old plants that have to be replaced, we have to do a lot of nuclear construction just to keep capacity flat. This scenario assumed a 40-year plant life. And I know in the U.S., life extension is happening to quite a few of the plants, which will change this figure a bit. But if you believe in 40-year plants, we have to build 283 new nuclear plants worldwide just to keep nuclear capacity flat by 2025. So that's commissioning 12 to 15 new reactors per year globally. Right now we're commissioning 2 to 3. So if we only commission 2 to 3, this is the trajectory for global nuclear capacity. To grow nuclear capacity, we'd have to build significantly more nuclear reactors. The IEA's alternative policy scenario would require 482 nuclear reactors, the new ones, by 2025. The fuel supply issue with nuclear, it turns out that all of the uranium mines in the world only produce about two-thirds of the uranium required by all of the reactors in the world. The balance is provided by nuclear stockpiles, primarily in the Soviet Union. If we really ramped up nuclear, how long would nuclear resources last in the world? And if we keep using light water reactors once through technology, in this scenario, even with expansion of nuclear generation, all of the discovered and undiscovered uranium resources would be gone by 2070. The solution to nuclear long-term is breeder reactors, which use a much larger proportion of the energy that's in the fuel. The hydrogen economy, talked about less and less by many people these days. Is it a silver bullet? I would suggest that it's not. Most hydrogen is made from reforming natural gas or electrolysis. And there's an energy penalty to doing that. We lose about 30% of the energy in the gas and 28% of the energy in the hydrogen going to, though considering some of the other issues with hydrogen. There's been many very good studies of the hydrogen economy recently, one of the best ones by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, all of the problems with the so-called hydrogen economy. If we look at the energy density of energy carriers, this is things like batteries, which are the worst by weight and by volume. Hydrogen gas is not much better. Liquid hydrogen is a bit better, but you have to maintain it at minus 253 degrees centigrade, which is problematic. But there's nothing that can compare to things like gasoline, diesel fuel, and propane as convenient fuels to store, very compact, safe, very high energy densities. The last piece of the puzzle in my mind is population growth globally, and especially aspirations of growth and consumption of energy in the developing world. And if we look around the world, we can see there's a great inequity in consumption of energy worldwide. Canada, I hate to say it, is the worst in terms of per capita consumption, followed very closely by Americans. Canadians consume five times the world per capita average, nine times that of China, 30 times India, and 100 times Bangladesh. The problem is that countries like China have aspirations to radically grow their consumption of energy. And this is the history and forecast of population for China. They've almost doubled their population since 1965. They're working, with their one-child philosophy at curtailing population, but it's expected to plateau at about 1.4 billion people in 2030. They've quintupled their per capita consumption of energy since 1965, and they're forecast to double it again by 2030. China's total forecast consumption is forecast to double by 2030. Consumption by fuel. China is the biggest producer and consumer of coal in the world. The so-called Asia flu back in the late 90s impacted China's consumption of coal, but it didn't impact its consumption of oil at all. Consumption of oil just kept on growing. China was a net exporter of oil back in 1993. In 2006, it imported half of its oil. So 4% of global oil production is now imports into China. China still only consumes a third as much oil as the U.S. India. India is not working on its population. It's forecast to grow its per capita consumption by 40% and nearly double its total energy consumption by 2030. Oil into India, 70% of India's consumption of oil is now imports. The rest of developing Asia outside of India and China is forecast to nearly double its energy consumption by 2030, when it will have 1.4 billion people. If we compare population growth in the developing world, China, India, and the rest of Asia, compared to the U.S., Canada, and Europe. We can see that Europe will, in essence, plateau in terms of population by comparison to the developing world. India will be the most populous country in the world by 2030. On a per capita basis, however, the developing world has a long way to go. Europe is incredibly efficient in terms of per capita consumption compared to Canada or the U.S., for example, only about half. But if China is successful in doubling its per capita consumption, it will still only be about a quarter of U.S. Per capita consumption. Total energy consumption, if these scenarios work out, China will be the biggest energy consumer in the world by 2030. Total world population forecasts to plateau at about 9 billion people in 2050. I plotted motor vehicles on the same vertical axis. There's 850 million motor vehicles in the world at present, 240 million in the U.S., only 39 million in China. China's motor vehicle population is growing by 20% per year. There were 70 million new motor vehicles built in 2006 in the world, almost the same number of net people added to the planet. In a constrained hydrocarbon world, there's also the issue of food. And this is different strategies for getting food on an energy return on investment. So how much energy do we expend versus the energy that we get from eating the food? And it turns out that strategies like distant fishing, sending a fish boat across the Atlantic to get fish, is a very inefficient way to get food, about 15 to 1. Range-fed beef is very efficient. Feedlot beef is very inefficient. The U.S. food system has gone from 1 to 1 in 1910 to 10 to 1 in 1970 and is now about 17 to 1. And that's mainly hydrocarbon inputs, natural gas-based fertilizers, diesel fuel, and so forth. So returning to the dilemma, five times as many people using eight times as much energy per capita, 43 times as much consumption as in 1850, 89% non-renewable. If you believe the scenarios that I've shown you, 50% growth in energy consumption through 2030, this is what the world would look like in 2030 compared to 1850. Seven times as many people, each person consuming 10 times as much energy. A world that consumes 66 times as much energy as in 1850, 89% non-renewable. And I ask you, is that sustainable as a long-term strategy for this planet? A very wise statement from economist Kenneth Boulding back in the early 70s. Anybody who believes exponential growth can go on forever in a finite world is either a madman or an economist. Another pretty apropos saying by Mike Bartlett, the term sustainable growth is an oxymoron. Economics that demands continuous growth is just not sustainable on a long-term basis. The Mineral Information Institute, BABIE, this is updated every year, and these are the resources that will be consumed in the average American's lifetime, from the time of birth to death. 3.7 million pounds of minerals, metals, and fuels over their lifetime. So just to summarize, the five-fold expansion of global population since 1850 has been made possible by non-renewable fuels, the consumption of which pervades all aspects of society, food, transportation, communication. The eight-fold expansion of global per capita energy consumption since 1850 has been entirely a result of consumption of non-renewable energy. North America consumes a disproportionate amount of energy, five times the global per capita average. The developing world understandably aspires to North American energy consumption levels. However, finite non-renewable resources are unlikely to be sufficient to allow this to happen, setting the stage for global conflict over energy. The realities of the finite nature of non-renewable energy resources are now becoming evident. Peak oil in many producing countries, peak North American natural gas, a tenfold increase in uranium prices, imports of coal into the U.S. after centuries of self-sufficiency. Despite the hype, renewable technologies are extremely unlikely to be able to replace non-renewable energy in existing business-as-usual energy demand forecasts. A sustainable future lies in radically reducing and rethinking energy consumption. It requires a paradigm shift in the way we use energy. Forecasts of future consumption based on extrapolations of growth from the past, which ignore the physical limits of non-renewable resources and the technological and physical constraints on the rate of conversion to supply, mask the crucial issues facing us and lead to complacency, which makes the final transition much worse. Climate change is in the minds of the public and the rhetoric of the politicians. The energy sustainability dilemma is much less understood, although it's highly likely to have more immediate and severe impacts on our current lifestyle and climate change, which we will likely have to live with for centuries. Many, but not all, the solutions proposed for climate change also address energy sustainability. The number one priority is energy conservation and much greater efficiency. And there are many opportunities for doing this, followed by technologies and lifestyle changes to reduce dependence on non-renewable fuel sources. A sustainable energy future is not out of reach, but will be hugely challenging. This will be a very difficult problem. We have to be thinking in the 10 to 20 year time frame to develop the infrastructure for alternatives as well as technologies and incentives to reduce consumption. There's some very interesting artwork on display in New York at this time, which I thought are really sick for some of the waste in our society, some of the low-hanging fruit. And that's the good part of this message, is there's a lot of things that we can do easily to reduce consumption. 2 million plastic beverage bottles are the number used in the U.S. every 10 minutes. And this is a huge mural that you can walk right up to and see every individual bottle. 50,000 plastic bags, the number used in the U.S. every 10 seconds. 426,000 cell phones, the number retired in the U.S. every 2 days. 11,000 jet trails, the number of commercial flights in the U.S. every 12 hours. And I'm responsible for 4 of those, just getting down here to tell you about this. So I'd like to conclude, despite the proponents of infinite growth and the ability of the markets and technology to overcome all obstacles, there's one supreme overriding principle. Energy consumption cannot exceed energy supply. Therefore, the reality of finite non-renewable energy resources will force a transition to a sustainable energy future. So there's really only one question. How will this transition occur? Will we be smart enough and visionary enough to manage the transition, the power down, or will we let the transition manage us? Jared Diamond wrote a very interesting bestseller back in 2005 called Collapse, Why Ancient Societies Succeeded and Failed. He looked at societies like the Easter Islanders that clearly failed, the Mayans, the Tikapians that made it, the Vikings in Greenland. And he ended his book with what I thought was a very appropriate comment for our time. A lower impact society is the most impossible scenario for our future, except for all other conceivable scenarios. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Questions from members? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know I've got another committee here in a few minutes. I just had I'd like to pick your mind on a couple of thoughts. So sooner or later, we're going to have to face issues like this. And I want to talk about the speed of society. I want to talk about adiabatic oil formation theory. Then I want to come back to a law of thermodynamics. And I'll try to be brief, because any one of them can take all night and a whole pitcher of beer to talk about. There is kicked around out there the former Soviet theory of oil formation called the adiabatic theory, that the Earth is continually actually producing crude. Is that factored into this at all, or what has been your experience in dealing with that that concept?
Yeah, the world produced the oil that it did produce over about 500 million years. Oil is certainly being formed on this planet, but not at a rate that is significant in any way, shape, or form. Like, I think the concept of abiotic oil, you know, producing or refilling reservoirs at a meaningful rate is a pipe dream. That would be, you know, my assessment.
I take it your thinking is then that the rate could not possibly keep up with the rate that we're burning through it now, then,
right,
if it's happening, then. Related to that has to do with the speed of our lives. I heard a fascinating dissertation one time in a completely different setting that, particularly as it relates to computer efficiency, you know, the halving of speed every so many months, that pretty soon the halving of speed gets to be such a small number that it almost becomes meaningless. But particularly for our lives and the pace we're living, and I'm not going to ask you to answer that because I want to get on to thermodynamics, but just know that in other disciplines and other areas of life, the same kind of question is coming up, sustainability, and has nothing to do with energy and has everything to do with our human capacity to live at the pace with which we're living, just from our very souls, I guess. There seems to be a meeting of several cruxes or fulcrum points here at the moment. I'm not a physicist, but I remember enough of rudimentary thermodynamics to know that for anything to happen, heat has to be released somewhere. You know, whether we're going to prevent freezing to death and we discover fire thousands of years ago, or whether we want to multiply our muscles and do things like grind wheat or propel ourselves down a highway or fly through the sky, somehow something has to burn. Energy has to be transferred into some sort of rotational mass so that we can do useful work with it. So far, it seems that hydrocarbons have been propelling that for the last 100 and some years. Is there anything on the horizon, any other new physical law we haven't discovered yet, kind of like the undiscovered oil, that will help us either get beyond turning things into heat to accomplish work, or are we always going to be bound by having to have energy converted to heat to get things done? You follow where I'm going? You follow the question? You know what I'm asking?
Mr. Hughes.
You know, I wish I could say yes. There's been a lot of smart people looking at this for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The energy of the sun, of course, is nuclear fusion. And nuclear fusion has been a holy grail of the physics community for a long time. And I graduated in the early 70s, and I heard that nuclear fusion would be here in 30 years. President Bush, in 2003, said that nuclear fusion may be here by 2050.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I think it's a worthwhile goal, or maybe it is something. It still is heat, in essence. But I think it's very dangerous to assume that there is a silver bullet out there that can magically replace all the fossil sunshine that's locked up in hydrocarbons.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should be looking for it, but to plan our future on it would be foolhardy, in my view.
In essence, Mr. Chairman, and I'll conclude with this remark, everything we're doing comes from the sun, whether it's coal or whether it's oil or whether it's wind power or hydropower. Even, you know, the sun makes water evaporate and rain runs down a river and we spin a turbine with it. Everything seems to revolve around that heat source. At the end of the day, whether it was created 500 million years ago or yesterday with wind differentials in South Dakota or something, but yeah, it seems like we're bound to heat, we're bound to the sun somehow. And like I say, some night you can buy me a pitcher of beer and we can shoot the breeze about that all night, I guess.
Yeah,
we should do that in committee, Mr. Chair, actually.
Perhaps that would be a good interim project. But, Mr. Hughes, with the response.
Well, my response is just, oil is a very inefficient converter of sunshine. In terms of how much of the sun that falls on the earth is actually turned into oil in a given year, coal is a little bit better. I've heard numbers, very small numbers for conversion into oil. Numbers that are, if we don't cut all the biomass down to make houses, the amount that could be converted into coal could be as much as, 5% of the sunshine that falls on the planet. They're fabulously dense fuels, fabulously concentrated stores of fossil sunshine, but we can't expect them to be, created fast enough to allow for current levels of consumption in any way, shape, or form.
That's it. For further questions from members, Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hughes, I'm assuming you probably read our peak oil resolution in the course of your communication with Mr. Hilty. And I'm wondering, first of all, given the scenario that you've carved out for us to look at, if you think the peak oil resolution is the right direction to be going, and if you have any other additional advice to us as state leaders.
Mr. Hughes.
I was very impressed with it, frankly. I read it in detail, I must admit, just last night. I skimmed it earlier, but I looked at it in detail. And I thought it was very good. I thought it was, in fact, visionary compared to what's happening in other jurisdictions. I think I said right at the very beginning that awareness is the first step. And that resolution goes a long way to promoting awareness. And some of the resolutions that are at the end, basically to inventory this so we can understand it more clearly and, go forward with a plan is absolutely crucial. I think it's a really good start.
Mr. Hughes. Further questions from members? Members, one of the things that You may have caught, I sent around a little brief video to members quite some time ago now that I entitled "Are Legislators Smarter Than Yeast?" It was just a little illustration of exponential growth. Representative Pawlowski replied to that. Bill, you should not ask questions you don't know the answer to. But I think that one of the things that was mentioned in that video, which illustrated how rapidly things do grow and how infrequently we seem to recognize that, is what I think is a very simple calculation that we all really ought to keep in mind every day as we consider policy in the legislature, and that is what's known as the rule of 70, which doesn't have anything to do with teacher retirement, but it's just a simple means of calculating when things are growing at a given percentage per year, say 2%, as we think is sort of the minimum we can grow our economy that's based on cheap fossil fuels. If you simply divide that rate of growth into 70, it tells you at what point you will have doubled whatever you started with. So we are committed to an economic theory that says that we do need to have that kind of growth. And if you simply observe the rule of 70, what we're saying is that in 35 years from now, we expect to be expect to have an economy. And again, let me remind you that right now that is based, I think, unarguably on cheap fossil fuels. We expect that in 35 years we're going to be using twice as much of that as we are now. And my question is, if we don't start thinking about this, where is this going to come from? Just where are we going to get twice as much as we're using right now in 35 years? So, pretty optimistic scenario, and that is really what is responsible for my having brought forward this resolution, which simply asks the legislature and this administration to acknowledge that this is a problem and to start looking into it. So I would, at this time, I guess, sort of revert to consideration of the resolution, and I would renew by motion that House File 995 be recommended to pass and placed on a general register, and would entertain any comments or questions about that at this time, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we should try to figure out a scenario where we can have a minus 2% growth. Maybe we could survive a little better, a little longer, and help our future generations out. I don't know how we can do that, but certainly we have to consider what we've done in the past and using renewables. I think of peat in two counties. They say we have enough peat to heat every home for 1,500 years. I think somehow we have to look at things like that and see how we can environmentally make those decisions.
Well, I think there's a lot of very hard decisions that need to be made. Representative Gunther. Representative Western.
Chair, just to the Mr. Hughes, I'm just curious on your thoughts of ethanol, biodiesel, other forms of those types of energies. I know Canada maybe doesn't have as much progress or push for it. I'm not exactly sure where Canada's at, but what's your thoughts on that?
Mr. Hughes.
Yeah, Canada's importing corn from the U.S. and turning it into ethanol. There's been several studies on the energy return on investment in ethanol. Some of them have been published by Pimentel from Cornell, Pimentel and Patrick, and they claim that if you add up all of the energy inputs into corn-based ethanol, it's energy negative by 29%. So it takes 29% more energy to make the ethanol than you actually get out of it by burning it. There was another study that came out in July of 2006. I think it was the University of Minnesota, if I'm not mistaken. And it suggested that ethanol from corn is about 30% positive. However you slice it, it's a very poor way to get liquids, you know, by comparison to a vertical well in Saudi Arabia back in the 50s. The other issue is using food for fuel as opposed to food to eat. There's a couple of very interesting studies that were published in Science, the journal Science, in January. And they looked at, you know, basically taking marginal land or taking forested land out of, basically clearing it to grow biofuels, and looking at the total CO2 emissions of doing that, like burning the rainforest in Indonesia, for example, and the peat. And in some cases, it took decades or centuries before you netted out a net CO2 positive balance by doing that. That was revolutionary because, of course, people are talking about using biofuels as a way to cut the carbon footprint. And I really don't think there's even a fraction of the arable land that's not being used for food to be put into biofuels to even make a dent. You know, like that chart that I showed you, which was the EIA reference case for biofuels, all of them in total was about 2 million barrels per day. And that's out of a, you know, 120 million barrel per day energy market. So it's a big mistake to, you know, I don't think under any scenario can business as usual be prolonged for much longer in the future. I think we really have to totally rethink and, you know, first of all, knock our consumption down absolutely as much as possible, and then look at a lot of incremental things that can be used to, you know, displace non-renewable energy for the fraction that's left.
Representative Counsel.
I certainly agree with you right now of using corn-based ethanol. If we planted every tillable acre in the United States in corn, we'd only replace 12.5% of fossil fuels we use. However, there are some plants like macantus that will grow that will produce 17 times more ethanol per acre than corn will. We just have to find the right enzymes to get that done. They do it in the laboratory today. They will do it in practice in the future, so that will give us a third crop. And I think the potential is there. I've looked at the evolution of the corn-based ethanol industry. I do hope in Canada you are importing that Minnesota corn to produce ethanol next to a power plant that you can use our heat. And that way it makes much better energy saver. So as far as using corn, food is not being foregone. And where I live, a 75-mile circle around where I live, they produce 1.2 billion bushels of corn. All the uses, including feed for animals, ethanol, everything, they consume half of that corn. So that means we are sending Canada some of our 600 million bushel surplus.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the resolution here, I appreciate what the intent of the resolution is. And I'm going to talk about a part I think that, first let me talk about the positive, then I'll talk about my perceived negative. Lines 212 to 215, speaking about Minnesota's demonstrated leadership in confronting different difficulties and so on. I think that's very true. And I think it's the people of Minnesota, the folks that get up every day and love their work or their calling in life and sit around dreaming up solutions to problems. That's a good thing. That's part of our gene pool, I suppose you could say. I will acknowledge most of it came from Scandinavian chairmen, but that's good. Good for us, good for America. Which brings me to where I have my heartburn on lines 119 through line 121. You know I'm a marketplace disciple. In spite of the last guy that was here, Mr. Simmons, I think very highly of Adam Smith and the marketplace. And we're talking about price signals. The assumption in the resolution is that price signals are going to be insufficient and that the marketplace is going to be inadequate to address this. I would submit just the opposite is true. When we look at the conversation we're just having here about corn and what happens whenever the government does intervene at all levels, with the best of intentions, folks, we end up monkeying around with things and screwing things up. We think we can create ethanol in a vacuum, and by golly, it affects the price of sawdust in Montana. That everything is connected, and it's all connected through the great equalizer, which is called money. Money flows freely in a free market, and it tells us where people's demand is and where we should be focusing our attention. I think $112 barrel oil is sending us a very clear message that this is a serious problem, folks, and I'm going to predict it's not going down anytime soon unless we fall into negative economic growth, which would be a pretty amazing and dreadful thing. So I guess I'm like 75% on supporting Resolution 995, House File 995, except I wish we would show more respect in our resolution for the power of the marketplace and the signals it sends, not only to people who actually get up in the morning and like to make a living, but there are some gifted people out there with some great ideas. And if the marketplace is turned loose on them, I'm a little more optimistic than others, perhaps, that there is something out there. We can't undo the laws of physics, which is why I was asking about thermodynamics. Those three laws just are. We have to obey them.
In fact, it's impossible for us not to obey them. But I think there's some ways around things, including conserving, which is driven largely by price, most efficiently driven by price. Distributed generation, finding other ways to do things than what we've done before. But I think that if we allow the marketplace to do that, and government's role is to inform and to educate and to referee the playing field, but to pretty much stay out of the way and not mandate stuff, I'm convinced the marketplace can do this more efficiently and more effectively than massive government intervention. And I guess that's all I have to say about that, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Bearden. And, you know, I'm really interested in having a discussion with you about this. I think this falls into that interim project that we were discussing earlier. I would just say that without trying to initiate that discussion at this time, that I think one of the things we've experienced about the market is that it rarely looks 20 or 30 years out for the signals that it's sending. And I think that, and I guess I do have to say myopia on the part of the market, I think, is what is responsible for my putting this in the bill. I think that at best we have a much shorter time than would actually be required to make any kind of, and once we recognize that this is a problem, to make any kind of a smooth transition to account for it.
Mr. Chairman, so there were two thoughts that occurred where I find some areas of agreement. I agree that the myopic quarterly performance that seems to drive most Wall Street brokerages, I would agree with you. That's way too short. The second thing had to do with transparency in the marketplace. That is one role that government, I think, needs to play and ought to play to help make sure there's transparency in what we're really dealing with. And there, I know we get into some national sovereignty issues with people that are hiding their cards and maybe doing it for interests other than the best interests of the marketplace. But you'd find me agreeing with you there.
Thank you. Any further discussion to the bill? Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at lines 2.5 to 2.7. When you talk about soil fertility and impacting agricultural sustainability, what do you mean by that?
I'm sorry, you're representing...
2.5 to 2.7. Is that, Mr. Chairman, nitrogen fertilizer for corn, or...
Well, Representative Magnus, that would certainly be one of the considerations. The way we're currently practicing agriculture is, I think we all recognize, is highly hydrocarbon intensive. You know, not only the fuel that powers the machinery that's involved, but also the all herbicides and pesticides are petroleum-based. Fertilizers are mostly natural gas-based. We see a decline in those resources. It's going to have an obvious effect on the kind of agricultural productivity that we're accustomed to.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to address that a little bit and to throw out some new information that... certainly our yields, and I'll just take corn for example, and corn is different than soybeans. Soybeans are a legume, and they actually take nitrogen from the air, put it into the soil. So if you follow a crop rotation and you follow soybeans with corn, you can generally credit quite a bit of nitrogen used to soybeans. In fact, the rule of thumb has generally been if you have 45 bushel soybeans, you'll have about 45 pounds of nitrogen in the soil to use for corn sustainability and corn fertilizer. And now, Mr. Chairman, biotechnology has had a tremendous effect on agriculture. and especially on corn. And there's billions and billions of dollars a year going into this, and now that Europe is being drug into the 21st century and is accepting biotechnology now, because they really have no other choice, basically. I think you'll see increased investments in biotechnology. Our corn yields are increasing at about 2 bushels a year, which is sped up over even fairly recent increases in yields. And our fuel consumption has declined, not only per acre as we go across less trips across the field, but certainly with the increase in production, the fuel use, for example, has decreased significantly per bushel. And recently the need to, if this global warming is in fact true, certainly we're not going to be needing to dry corn, and I haven't dried corn on my farm for the last 4 years. It's just a combination of better hybrids that require, that dry down faster and require less drying in the fall. And I think that's a major factor. But Mr. Chairman, I've been watching the biotechnology efforts quite a bit, and understand that they're getting close to developing a corn hybrid that will act similar to soybeans. Will actually assimilate nitrogen from the air, and the need to add additional nitrogen as fertilizer will likely be completely gone. So my point, Mr. Chairman, is that things are working in the favor, you know, and I think if we look at, and I did that for the benefit of you too, sir, to look at some of these new developments that are happening, because I think your presentation was excellent. I thought it was very, very good. But there's just to throw out the newest information that's going on in this agricultural system that's gone on since day one, and I think it's going to continue to go on. We do adapt to things.
Well, thank you, Representative Magnus. I would certainly not dispute that that there's a lot of positive change that is taking place, and that certainly has the potential for taking place, but I hope you're not, you know, I hope your conclusion is not that therefore we have nothing to worry about.
Oh, no, I didn't say that. I'm just trying to update the committee on what's going
on. Thank you. Members, we do have Representative Canoe's bill that we need to take up later this afternoon, or I guess we're talking about maybe this evening. If there's no further discussion to this bill, I would like to wrap this up and declare a recess until 6 o'clock, in which case, at which time, are we back in this room? Which time we'd reconvene in the basement to take up House File 3195. Representative Westrom?
Mr. Chair, just in the resolution, do you know that refers to global oil protocol? Is that something that in the future would be developed, or is there already a document out there, and what's all in that?
Representative Westrom, there have been a number of suggestions about what that would consist, and there are a few competing versions of the protocol, but just basically what they're talking about here is that what we need to do is essentially convene a global conference on this, in which by diplomatic means we would sort of allocate percentages of a declining resource so that everyone using these resources would agree to diminish their use of the resource relative to the overall recognized decline. So if we recognize that petroleum is just
and it's a lot more complex than this, but just to put it as simply as possible, if we recognize that global petroleum production is decreasing at a rate of, say, 2% per year, what we would try to work out an agreement to is that we would agree to decrease our consumption by a like amount, so that we try to avoid resource wars and things, you know.
Okay.
We don't care what happens to you, we're going to continue using as much as we like.
All right, thanks.
And this is, at this point, merely a concept. It's not anything that has been introduced or actually
exists
anywhere.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Is this language that you picked up from other states or from conferences, or is this language that you and our House research draft, or is this a bigger effort by some group, and that's where the language came from, or any clarity on that?
Representative Westrom, a number of resolutions have been introduced across the country, most of them local units of government, city councils and county units across the country have adopted resolutions that are drafted specifically to their circumstances. I've been aware of those resolutions, read a number of them, and what I did in putting this together is just try to take the general principles that I think are expressed in all of those and incorporate them into this resolution in a way that I thought fit our circumstance in Minnesota.
Thanks.
I should ask, before asking for a vote on the bill, if there's anyone in the audience that would wish to testify for or against it. Mr. Harrison?
I'm here.
Go to the table.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Harrison, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Norm Erickson. I'm from Rochester, and I'm here because of this resolution. About 5-6 years ago, I read a book on vacation. It's called The Party's Over. And it ruined the vacation. And I've spent most of the last 5 or 6 years, most of my free time, following this issue around the world, and it's real and it's big, and we can wish all we want that it would go away. And I think our kids are going to live in a really different world, and you ought to put some heat on the governor to address it. Our legislators in general aren't talking about it out there in the hustings. Our newspapers aren't covering the issue. People on the street aren't talking about it. I lead Buckthorn volunteer work in our park system in Rochester. And captive audience, you know. I was giving a little orientation pitch, 15 or 20 minutes. Well, now it's 3/4 peak oil. I say, how many of you in a group of 15 or 20, what do you know about peak oil? Is it peak what? I mean, there's no buzz about it. There's no conversation about it. And it is the biggest issue on the horizon. And I estimate within 5 years, that's going to be the dominant issue throughout this state, in our personal lives, and in this country, and in the planet. We're sliding into the ditch, guys, and we've got to do something. This is just the barest little beginning. It's nothing to what you're going to have to deal with in a few years. Pass it.
Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Anyone else wish to comment? Sir.
My name is John Frizee. I make my living as a software engineer in Minneapolis. It's been brought up that peak oil, the relationship between peak oil and the free market, and should we let this happen by market mechanisms, the solution, or should we actually have government work to address the issue? And I wanted to address that just a little bit because, well, the free market's been very good to me and my company. It's an excellent concept, but it's got some limitations that I think especially need to be addressed when you're thinking about this. One is that no individual private citizen can purchase a light rail train powered by electricity. No one person. We can get a Prius that doubles our efficiency, but we can't get to 600 miles per gallon of wind-generated electricity moving us by transportation, okay? So in some sense, the free market can't solve that problem. And in the other sense, I think the time issue that Representative Kilty brought up is incredibly important in that it takes decades to make these kinds of changes. We've seen just in the last 3 or 4 years, the price of oil has more than tripled. How can something that takes 20 years to mitigate be dealt with if the price goes 3, 4, 10 times higher in less than a decade? These things take forward planning that only essentially governments can provide. The price signal doesn't exist early enough to take correct action. We still don't have profitable wind out in western Minnesota without government support. And how can that be when our natural gas, which is going to supply our future electrical energy, is going to go away? So we're essentially caught in this position where the free market is a great strategy, but the signal isn't going to be there soon enough to get the infrastructure in place that's going to be large enough to actually mitigate the issue. But that's the piece that I wanted to bring up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Jack Rossbach. I just want to say this is a wonderful resolution, and I'm so happy that it's brought forward and we can consider it in Minnesota, because I think it's part of what we're going to have to look at really quick, and the discussion has started. The concept of reducing our gross domestic product by 2% is exactly what I have come to believe in 1995. I gave up 95% of my income. I worked for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration because I realized that this moment was coming and that we would get to the point where people are going to have to give something up. They're going to have to sacrifice. Now, this year's 2% will probably be lost in our recession. Let's start thinking about that 2% for next year. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, seeing no one else, and our membership rapidly melting away, I would renew my motion that House File 995 be recommended to pass and placed in a general register. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
Nay.
Motion is adopted. The bill is passed. Members, with that, we will recess and reconvene at 6 p.m. in the basement to take up House File 3195. Make sure you get something to eat really fast. With that, we are in recess. Representative, we ready to go?
Are they on now?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 3195. Be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register or Finance Committee.
Yeah, so it needs to go back to Finance.
Yes. Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Okay. House Bill 3195 is a bill about setting some principles for and having some legislative involvement in and studying some of the impact of a cap and trade program for the Midwest region that is currently actually being negotiated by the governor and appointed representatives through the Midwestern Governors Association and the Midwestern Greenhouse Gas Accord. So the bill is in three parts, and I'll just walk through all those parts really quickly. But first, just I think everyone's pretty familiar with what a cap and trade program it is, but simply we put goals into statute last year for specific greenhouse gas reductions with an ultimate goal of an 80% reduction by 2050, and a cap and trade program is a major tool in reaching those goals. It limits the amount of carbon dioxide that's allowed to be put out in the region and the sectors covered by the cap and trade program, and emitters of greenhouse gases are required to hold allowances to emit, which are the equivalent of a permit to allow them to emit that amount of carbon or greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And that cap gets lowered over time, and the market is used to find the cheapest reductions in our greenhouse gas emissions. So the first part of the bill basically states it's the intent of the legislature to participate in a Midwest cap and trade program to help achieve the goals that we set in statute last year. We recognize that the atmosphere and climate are common assets, and damage done by the greenhouse gas emissions are costs that are now borne by the public. And by putting a cap, we put a market value on emissions, and we believe that any value of those, that market value should go to the public. It's the intent that the study, which I'll talk about later, should be taken into consideration when we're developing a cap and trade program, as well as a few principles. And just to note, these principles have changed quite a bit since when we introduced the bill. And we've worked with various stakeholders to try to get more mutually agreed upon language. So number one is basically stating it. We're covering as many sectors as possible, or as administratively feasible, excluding sectors in which emissions cannot be reliably quantified, and then giving particular scrutiny to looking at the transportation sector and whether those emissions can be reliably quantified. Number two is stating that the allowances should be auctioned in their initial distribution to the extent economically feasible, and making sure that all of those proceeds benefit the public. And this is a big change from when the bill was introduced, where there was 100% auction stated as a principle. This would allow for a hybrid system where some allowances are auctioned and some are freely distributed. Again, talking about the auction, it could be phased in if necessary to protect consumers as well as industries from sudden price increases, and making sure that no windfall profits accrue as a result of a cap and trade program. Number four is about making sure the emissions necessary to meet the cap and meet our goals come from within the cap sectors. And number five is not allowing emissions outside of the cap, reductions of emissions outside of the cap, to count towards meeting the cap. And finally, number six is talking about wanting the cap and trade system to be as fair and equitable as possible, making sure certain communities don't have disproportionate economic and environmental risks. And that could be anyone from a community that lives close to a power plant that might be ramped up if another one is shut down, to a community where a significant number of people work in an energy-intensive industry. Section 3 is asking a couple of departments to report back to the legislature about the ongoing work of the Minnesota Governors Association and under the Midwest Minnesota Governors Association, working on the Midwestern Greenhouse Gas Accord. And again, they're already working towards developing a model rule for cap and trade, and we should be seeing that rule on November 15th of this year. Part B of Section 3 is appointing six legislators to serve an advisory role to this group, receiving information and offering advice to the negotiators, and then making sure that any cap and trade program Minnesota was to join was enacted into law by the legislature. Section 3 is a couple studies. One is the first is a governance study. Should there be an auction, it could bring in a sizable amount of revenue, and making sure that we govern that revenue in a way that is effective in terms of reaching the goals that we lay out in the economic and emissions study. The economic and emissions study looks at the cost of various parts of the cap and trade program on industries or jobs, and makes sure we have a clear understanding of that. And it also looks at the benefits of certain parts of the cap and trade program, and environmental benefits, benefits in new types of jobs, and various uses of the revenue. Should there be an auction for direct rebates, a transition to a more more energy efficient society, as well as things like job training for more forward-looking green-collar jobs. And that's a basic synopsis of the bill. And I do have an author's amendment.
Representative Knuth, I think we have something of a problem with the amendments lining up to the second engrossment. If you can give us guidance on your amendment to see if that in fact does line up as you intended, I think we could probably act on that one at least. We're trying to sort that out as sort of on the fly.
It might be helpful if somebody somewhere has a copy of the first engrossment to our house that originally drafted where some of these things are still
going. I have one.
Oh.
Oddly enough.
Mr. Chair, what's the amendment number?
The 828 amendment. I could tell it.
Representative Smith.
The line 1.2 and 1.3 on the amendment should actually read page 2, line 11. Delete everything after commerce. And page 2, line 12, delete everything before shall. So basically deleting "and the commissioner of the pollution control agency." And then,
and we can incorporate that in your amendment, Representative Knuth?
Yes. And then the line 1.4 on the amendment should read I think that actually that amendment works as drafted to the second.
It appears on Representative Knuth that the other change in your amendment would have to be on line 12.
Yep.
To delete 17 and insert 24.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, on that page 5.
Representative Briner.
Should it say page 5, section 5? Delete everything after A?
Mr. Eloff, can you give us an opinion on that? Is that necessary?
I could if I could hear the question again, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
Representative Briner.
On the amendment, line 1.4, it says page 5. Delete everything after A. I'm wondering if it should say page 5, section 5.
Mr. Chair, I think... go ahead, Mr. Eloff.
I think it should say, I think we should say page 5, line 21.
Very well. We'll incorporate that also on line 4 of the amendment after page 5, comma, and third page 21. I mean line 21. So, Mr. Eloff, can you, for the record, tell us what the amendment with those changes incorporated, how that reads?
We're now looking at line 1.2 of the amendment, which says page 2, line 11, delete everything after commerce. Line 1.3 of the amendment says page 2, line 12, delete everything before the word shall. Line 1.4 says page 5, line 21, delete everything after paragraph A. And the rest of that amendment is as reads down to line 111. And on line 112, it says page 5, delete line 24, and insert the material in quotes.
Thank you. So, Representative Knuth moves the A28 amendment with the changes incorporated as noted. Is there a discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Is that your only amendment, Representative Smith?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. And there are several people in the audience who could testify to this bill, but in respect of committee members' time, we have a Clean Energy Minnesota, Minnesota Environmental Partnership, the AFL-CIO, the IBEW also supports the bill. And I don't see a representative from the Minnesota Budget Project, but they're usually here. And they'd be willing to answer questions should we need them to answer questions.
We will give everyone who feels compelled to testify an opportunity to do that, Representative Knuth. And we do have a number of amendments. Some, it's not clear whether they are intended to be offered or not, but some clearly are. The first that we will take up is the A23 amendment. Well, no, I guess we can't take up the A23 amendment because the author of the amendment is not here unless someone else wants to offer it. So, we
Mr. Chair,
A23 for the moment. Representative
Lester. Mr. Chair, I think Representative Hackbus juggling between committees. Do you want to take up amendments before we hear any testifiers on the bill, or is that your plan?
That was my plan, Representative Western.
Okay. I think there's a few other amendments we could offer that intend to be offered if we want to hold up an A23.
Is anyone wishing to claim the A22 amendment?
Yeah, Gunther.
Representative Gunther?
Mr. Chairman, this amendment basically is an amendment for economic development. We look at
Representative Gunther, could you pull your mic down?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move the A22 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Gunther, I think we'll have to ask you to incorporate a change on line 2, delete 29 and insert 32 to line up with the second engrossment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we do that.
I think you can just incorporate
that in my amendment, then.
Mr. Representative Gunther. So, to the A22 amendment, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an amendment that helps with the economic development. It is pretty well known that the number one issue as far as people in Minnesota are concerned are jobs and economic development. We're entering in a time of recession. And in order to ensure that cap and trade does not have the negative connotations of hurting the recovery, I thought that we would have this amendment. In line 1.3, any cap and trade agreement entered into this section are void for a period of 1 year if for two consecutive quarters. One, the growth of Minnesota's gross domestic product growth is less than 1% on an annual basis. Two, the state's unemployment rate exceeds 6%. And three, the state's urban consumer price index increases by more than 4% on an annual basis. This ensures that this will not harm because of higher utility prices or whatever, the recovery of our economy. And that's why I bring this amendment forth. I'll certainly stand for any questions.
Representative Snooks, you wish to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dunthewaile, I appreciate your concern about jobs and a recession. I would oppose this amendment because I think it's not looking at all of the influences that are affecting our economy right now, as well as creating uncertainty in a market that we're trying to create some certainty in with the cap and trade program. And just a comment about jobs, as we transition to a lower carbon economy and more energy efficient economy, we're creating all sorts of opportunities for jobs and windows and insulation, jobs that you can't send overseas because they have to happen here in Minnesota, where the actual infrastructure is. So I think that's an important part as well of the cap and trade program, is it creates the opportunity for many different kinds of jobs. But I would oppose this amendment.
Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knuth, I certainly appreciate your statement very much, but this is just a safeguard to make sure if our economy does go south that we can put these aside until it happens. It's not a permanent solution, permanently doing what you want to do. It's just saying, if these things happen, which would be very harmful to our economy, that we would consider holding these back for a period of time. I certainly agree that we have to, it will create jobs. I agree with that completely. It's going to create jobs where I live, in greater Minnesota. It's something that a lot of people in my district are looking forward to. But what I'm worried about is the overall economy, and I think this is a safeguard, and I appreciate your consideration of this amendment. I ask for a roll call vote, please.
Excuse me. Roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Gunther, am I recalling correctly that it was only maybe an hour and a half ago that you said something about perhaps the necessity of reducing the GDP by 2%
per year? Mr. Chairman, your ears are very, very good, and I totally believe in that. Like I believe in this. I'm saying, what if? And I'm concerned about jobs. I'm concerned about growth in the economy and getting out of this recession. I am truly looking forward to having a surplus again.
Is there a further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll. The chair votes no.
Reiner.
Lie.
No.
Reiner.
No.
Gardner.
No.
Gunther.
Yes.
Hackbart.
Yes.
Poppy. Not
here.
Johnson.
Nope.
Kalen.
Hey.
Canoe.
No.
Magnus. Nornis.
Yes.
Osmond.
Yes.
Peterson.
No.
Rude. Taylor.
No.
Slocum. Virginia. Welty.
No.
Weston.
Yes.
Seeing 6 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Representative Hackbarth, we skipped over the A23 amendment in your absence. You just offer that.
Sorry about that, Mr. Chairman. We're in another committee, and I just got out of there. Mr. Chairman, I'd move the A23 amendment. And this is pretty simple. Removes the prohibition on licensing nuclear power plants. Pretty simple, straightforward.
I'm sure this will not dissuade you in any way, Representative Hackbarth, but as I have stated before, we do mean to have hearings on this issue. Representative Mahoney and I are arranging to have a joint hearing on the nuclear energy issue. And personally, I think it's kind of premature to talk about doing this before we have the discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's been a bill introduced on this issue, hasn't there? And
there has, Representative. And that's what gave rise to my agreement that we would take this issue up and have as thorough a discussion as we can manage.
But Mr. Chairman, shouldn't we have done that a while ago? I mean, to meet the deadline.
Well, Representative Hackbarth, considering that, as far as I'm aware, no one has proposed to build a new nuclear power plant, and that if someone did propose to do so, we're talking about a minimum of a 10-year time frame. I don't think that there's any great urgency in doing this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if we had this law in place, I don't ever see or foresee anyone coming forward and proposing one. If we take this restriction out of the way, it could possibly happen. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask for a roll call.
Very well. Roll call has been requested. Is there any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll. Chair votes no.
Yes.
Aye.
Fly.
No.
Steiner. Gardner.
No.
Gunther.
Yes.
Hackbar.
Yes.
Poppy. Johnson.
No.
Kalen.
Nope.
Knuth.
No.
Magna. Norna.
Yes.
Osment.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Rude. Saylor.
No.
Slocum. Virginia. Welty.
No.
Westrom.
Yes.
There being 6 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Representative Norna, the A17 amendment, I believe, is yours.
That's correct.
And Representative Norna, I believe it will be necessary again with the alignment problem to line 2 of your amendment, delete 18 and insert 7, or delete 17 and insert 18, excuse me. If you would incorporate that in your amendment.
I will incorporate that. This amendment simply adds...
Just a moment. There still seems to be some confusion here. No. We're good.
Okay.
Representative Norris.
This amendment simply adds the words "are economically and" to line 18, and it goes after the "is." So it would read covering as many emitting sectors as is or are economically and administratively feasible.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Norris, for offering this amendment. I would oppose the amendment. We talk about auctioning to the extent economically feasible. I think that covers covers it pretty well, and I would oppose the amendment.
This is the Eastern. Representative North, I'm not sure I understand how economically fits in that context. Could you explain that?
Well, I have an email from Minnesota Utility Investors who claim that as written, without that amendment, it would be could be quite expensive to customers and have a negative impact on utilities' credit ratings. So, it just indicates that we need to take that into consideration as we're moving forward. In other words, if it's outrageously expensive, we probably wouldn't do it.
Well, Representative North, it's still not clear to me what we're asking to be economically feasible here. And I understand in the language as it exists, we say we want to cover as many emitting sectors as is administratively feasible, meaning which ones is it actually possible to identify and measure, et cetera. But I don't see how are we talking about being economically feasible to administrate, or are we I don't see how this refers to anything that would actually affect the economy. Representative Weston.
Mr. Chair, I'm not finding this amendment. Would Mr. Uvas be able to just read the section of the bill that, as it's amended?
Certainly.
And maybe he could offer some comments.
Go ahead.
Well, getting back on line 15 on page 1, it says it is the intent of the legislature that any cap and trade program developed pursuant to section 216H12.12 should take into account the results developed pursuant to section 216H12.12 should take into account the results of the studies required under section 216H.13 and should consider 1. Covering as many emitting sectors as are economically and administratively feasible, but excluding sectors from which emissions cannot be reliably quantified, giving particular scrutiny to whether emissions from the transportation sector can be reliably quantified.
Thank you. Representative Weston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Eloff. Mr. Chair, it seems to me that that's pretty, it's as clear as the word administratively feasible. I mean, it's things that they're going to have to take into consideration. This cap and trade issue is somebody's going to hoist a huge utility tax on consumers, and unless we do something to ratchet it down, and that's what we're looking to try to do is just have some balance in this as we look at it. But seems to me to make sense as it. Much sense as the other words in that line.
Mr. Chair, I ask for a roll call.
A roll call has been requested. Is there a further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll. Chair votes no.
Pierce.
Aye.
Lai.
No.
Reiner.
No.
Gardner.
No.
Semper.
Yes.
Kaplar.
Yes.
Poppy. Johnson.
No.
Kalin.
No.
Canoe.
No.
Magnus. Norner.
Yes.
Osmond.
Yes.
Peterson.
No.
Rude. Taylor. Slocum. Virginia.
No.
Westrom. Or Welty, excuse me.
No.
Westrom.
Yes.
There being six ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Like the next one on the list would be the A21 amendment. I believe that's yours, Representative Westrom. And again, with the alignment issue, we would ask you on line 2 of the amendment to delete 29 and insert 32. You would incorporate that in your amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A21 amendment and incorporate that change.
Thank you, Representative Westrom. Representative Westrom moves the A21 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure where this bill is going, but in the last few years, there's been a lot of pressure on utility rates. Mine locally were raised last spring by my utility company. Some 10% or so. We imposed this on our producers of utility rates. It really isn't going to affect the utility companies, Mr. Chair, nearly like it's going to affect the consumer, because that's the person who's paying the bill at the end, Representative Knuth, her constituents, your constituents, Mr. Chair, my constituents, are going to end up paying this in the end. I'd be interested from Representative Knuth what the estimated cost of this is going to be. I don't think we've got a real firm number, and so what this amendment would do is, we as a state, as important as this may be, then we need to lower those tax rates for the so the end producer, end user, doesn't have to pay more for their cost of doing business and creating jobs in the state of Minnesota than what this is going to increase. And so this would give a tax offset to match the cost increase to the end users. And I would ask members to support that, to at least have some rate neutral opportunity here. And I would ask for a roll call, Mr. Chair.
A roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Westrom, are we just supposed to assume with this amendment that if there were a tax, corporate tax reduction, and the question of who would be affected by this agreement anyway, and whether it's solely corporations that would be affected in the first place, but should we just assume that if there were a corporate tax rate reduction, that that would be used by a corporation to offset any expenses that they incurred in meeting the cap and trade agreements? And what about the corporations that actually benefit from cap and trade by being able to sell credits? Would they be included in this as well?
Mr. Chair, first of all, if you would want to add some comfort language to my amendment, I'd welcome that language to make it crystal clear. But the other thing is, the PUC sets rates for utility companies based on their expenses, and if the tax side expense goes down but their cap and trade regulation expense goes up and they offset, the PUC is going to be the adjuster based on law and current practices. And so I don't think it would be a problem, but I would welcome comfort language if Mr. Eloff can develop some.
Representative Westrom, has been a long day, and I'm not sure I have any comfort to offer at this point.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just trying to change that 6-10 vote pattern that's going on here, and thought maybe we'd have a bipartisan movement here.
Well, Representative Westrom, I'd like to give Representative Knuth an opportunity to comment on that, but before she does, I would like to point out also that there isn't anything in the amendment that says it applies only to utilities. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think you pointed out some of the problems with the amendment and the fact that it would be an across-the-board tax cut for corporations, whether or not they were paying more or less under a cap-and-trade program. And there's no guarantee that it would go to the people it purports to help, which are the ratepayers. And so I would oppose the amendment. And in terms of how much the cap-and-trade program costs, I would just reiterate that the governor is currently negotiating a model rule for a cap-and-trade program in the Midwestern Governors Association, having signed the Midwestern Greenhouse Gas Accord, and this sets out principles to make sure that our cap-and-trade program benefits the public, and it makes sure the legislature is involved, and I think we can all agree that the legislature should be involved in such an important process, and then it does set out studies so we have a better understanding of what the costs as well as the benefits of a cap-and-trade program would be.
Representative Weston.
Mr. Chair, first, maybe Mr. Eloff could just look for some language. If you would have a suggestion on how we could refine this to be targeted to either utilities or somewhere that the end user is going to get this reduction in the offset because of the rate. Mr. Eloff, if you'd have some ideas, I have a question for Representative Knuth first, and then I'll come back to see if you have. But Representative Knuth, what are some estimates of costs ranging from this bill? Any idea? Have you looked into that at all or not?
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that is a big reason why we have the study, and there's been a lot of work done, and one of the recent studies I've seen coming out of the consulting firm McKinsey is that the world could actually get about half of its greenhouse gas reductions at a net profit. And finding that second most energy inefficient sector in the world is the American housing sector. We're literally throwing money out our windows and doors and cracks in our houses, and I think that's not a smart way to be spending our money. We can all agree on that. So I'm not willing to just pull numbers out of a hat without having this study, which I'm proposing we have in this bill.
So,
Representative Weston.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knuth, are you saying that there's belief now that this would reduce costs rather than raise it?
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We get into a kind of a wide range of costs and costs on whom and benefits to society, environmental costs, health costs, and I wouldn't be bringing this forward if I didn't think it was a net benefit to Minnesota and the Midwestern region. I think that would be irresponsible of me. So I do think it's a net benefit, and part of the reason we have the study is to see, yes, the economic costs and the impacts on various industries and also the benefits of moving forward with a cap-and-trade program when we come back and are looking at the model rule that's negotiated under the Midwestern Greenhouse Gas Accord, we can have a better understanding of what that will mean.
Well, Representative Weston.
Mr. Chair, I find it interesting. You twisted the words a little bit, Representative Knuth. You don't want to identify the costs, and so then you twist the word to say net benefit, whatever benefit means, and whoever's going to define benefit. So I find it interesting. There really wasn't an answer to the question, and I think you do know this is going to be a cost. There's going to be less money in the people's pockets when they pay their bills because of this than there is today. I think that is probably not arguable. And so I think to believe differently is false hope for your constituents, I believe. But Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Eloff could get, if he has any ideas on.
Representative Weston, before we turn to Mr. Eloff, whose abilities I have a great deal of respect for, I'm not sure that we want to get into attempting to change this on the fly. I could point out that this bill, if it passes out of this committee, as we referred to the Finance Committee on which you serve, and perhaps
it would be prudent to work with Mr. Eloff and anyone else that you want to try to get that proposal refined before the bill is heard in finance. And if it isn't heard in finance, you won't have to worry about it anyway.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we should improve it along the way. I mean, ultimately, if we reduce the tax burden for anybody whose costs go up under this, that's essentially what this amendment would say. I guess I'm fine voting on this amendment if Mr. Eloff doesn't have any suggested language at this time.
Mr. Eloff?
Yes, I have some suggested language, although I'm not sure if we want the language to refer to utilities or all corporations subject to the cap and trade program, but we can figure that out later. Right now, this would be on page 1, line 2, after the word lowered, so we're saying the Minnesota corporate tax rate is lowered, for utilities participating in a cap and trade program implemented in Minnesota, provided that all resulting tax savings are used to reduce rates to energy consumers.
Representative Weston?
Mr. Chair, I think that certainly gets to the spirit of what we're trying to do, and so for now I would incorporate that as a change in my amendment.
Representative Westrom incorporates the changes as just articulated by Mr. Eloff. Representative Westrom, is it your intent then to limit this amendment only to utilities rather than other corporations that might be included in a cap and trade agreement as negotiated by the governor?
Mr. Chair, ultimately the utilities are the ones that are going to be passing on the costs, and so if we can do things to eliminate the costs they're going to have to pass on, it's going to benefit the end user. And Mr. Chair, I think there's another amendment or two. I might lay this over just temporarily and go up and visit with Mr. Eloff, if that's all right, and we can take another amendment up in the meantime.
Certainly, we can do that. Representative Westrom lays this amendment over temporarily. Mr. Pomeroy, we have another amendment. Representative Hackbarth, the A24 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll move the A24 amendment. Another pretty simple and straightforward amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hackbarth, once again, we have to accommodate the numbering discrepancies, and I believe what needs to be done in this amendment, if you would incorporate these changes, is delete the first one after page, insert two, and after line, delete 21 and insert one.
Correct. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would incorporate that.
Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. To your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Knuth, I don't see where you can possibly reverse the auction. I mean, we're phasing in an auction, but you don't have a chance to phase one out. And that's all this does, is this just creates the opportunity to phase out the auction also. That's all this does. I don't see anywhere else in the bill where that might happen.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hackbarth. I would oppose this amendment in terms of a cap and trade program work well. Economically, I think moving towards more of an auction is important. And as we get used to working under a cap and trade program, I think that's the way it will move. So I would oppose the amendment.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Knuth, I understand that, and it even says in your bill, to protect consumers and industry from sudden price increases. Now, what if something goes wrong and you need to get out of that or back it up? I mean, it just doesn't allow for that.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. with the way we have cap and trade programs moving now, they are moving towards auctions, and it's really a way to get the true price of an allowance, and making sure that the regulated industries aren't getting windfall profits, and making sure that the value of an allowance is used for the public benefit. And so, again, I would oppose the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm going to have to ask for a roll call vote. I just think this is a very important issue that we should contain in this bill, so this is going to pass and become law. So I'd have to ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Is there further discussion to the amendment? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, on page 2, it talks about windfall profits accrue, and you mentioned benefits to the public. What would be a definition of a windfall profit, first of all? The second part is, how do you envision capturing that for some perceived benefit to the public, and what would that benefit look like in your mind?
Baird, I presume that you're referring to the author of the bill and not the author of the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, it's been a long day. Yes, you're right, I am, and I can withhold that question until after we dispose of the amendment. However, the amendment does kind of strike to that section of the bill, and that's what inspired the question, her comments to the author of the amendment. So perhaps we should do that. If you'll hold that thought, Representative Canoes, we can save some breath when I ask it in a moment.
Certainly. Seeing no further discussion to the amendment, the clerk will take the roll. Chair votes no.
Beard.
Aye.
Fly.
No.
Reiner.
No.
Gardner.
No.
Spencer.
Yes.
Hatchbar.
Aye.
Poppy. Johnson.
No.
Kalin.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Magnus. Norness.
Yes.
Osmond. Peterson.
No.
Rude. Baylor.
No.
Slocum. Virginia.
No.
Welty.
No.
Westrom.
Yes.
There being 5 ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Representative Canoes, if you want to address Representative Beard's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Representative Beard, mm-hmm. for your question. Just referring earlier into the bill where this is intent and its principles that the legislature would like taken into consideration when the governor continues his negotiations for a model rule for a Midwestern cap and trade program. Part of the negotiations for these principles was to make them more broad, to make them apply as principles rather than prescriptive statements. So I don't have exact ways to have those protections. Those will be part of the negotiations, but this is just to make sure that protections are discussed and considered in the negotiations for a Midwestern cap and trade program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so there, I understand what you said is they're kind of a work in progress. The public that's going to benefit, and I can accept that, the public that will benefit, like in my version says line 2.8, it's number 6, providing for equity to communities. I have a hunch that's probably part of the public. By communities, do you mean like Worthington or Wyndham, or do you mean something else, like a political group of people or something, define that way?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Beard. It's meant for groups, and that might be geographic. It's likely geographic in terms of groups that are closer to a coal plant that might be fired up more as another one shut down. Taking that in consideration of it with the cap and trade program, communities where there might be significant proportion of the people who are employed in an energy intensive industry, and making sure that we are aware of that and take that into consideration and figure out how to address that. And so those are my two examples in terms of the communities that I'm referring to in that line.
I'm pondering what that means for this mission, Mr. Chairman. It sounds like it's going to be a pretty far-reaching, powerful, and busy committee. I think that's all for now. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Pomeroy, do we have another amendment? Representative Westrom, I believe you have some additional language to offer to...
Mr. Chair, I do. I'll just let Mr. Eloff read it.
Mr. Eloff?
The amendment would read, page 2, delete line 32, and insert, quote, "The Minnesota corporate tax rate is lowered for utilities sufficiently to offset producer cost increases estimated in the study conducted under section 216H.13, subdivision 2, paragraph D, clauses 1 and 2, provided that all resulting tax savings are used to reduce rates to energy consumers," end quote.
Is that your amendment?
That's my amendment, Mr. Chair.
To Western? Discussion to the amendment?
21.
Representative Newt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think the amendment is better drafted to get at its purpose. I think I still oppose the amendment. I still oppose the amendment.
Further discussion to the amendment?
No.
Representative
Weston? Mr. Chair, similar to what I said before, I mean, people need to realize moving forward with this system is not going to lower costs. While there might be other noble reasons to do it, why we would want to strap our constituents and job creators and threaten the economy potentially with some people not being able to absorb this kind of cost, I just think we should do an offset. As important as it may be, we should be willing as government to make sure the jobs stay here in the state of Minnesota and not put this cost increase on our consumers. It's pretty simple. Either we vote to keep our voters and constituents and business and job creators rates competitive and not raise them, or we vote to raise them. That's really what you can do.
Well, Representative Westrom, I think you're assuming that there is no cost to climate change. I mean, this started out, I believe, as the governor's initiative. He's the person that's leading the discussion in the Midwest governor's group to try to come to some agreement about this, and I've been under the impression that the underlying assumption is that not only are there clearly costs involved in climate change and continued emission of greenhouse gases, but that they could be so enormous that it's very difficult even to contemplate. So I don't think I agree entirely that there's only cost involved in trying to mitigate this problem and no cost involved if we don't.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm glad to see you becoming such a defender of the governor. That is great cooperation.
To some great degree, Representative Western.
Mr. Chair, it is of course our duties, and it's we as legislators that get to sign our names on bills or not on bills. But Mr. Chair, you know, depends upon what you're talking about. Climate change, it did cost me money this year for the climate change. My heating bills were up because I've used more gallons of fuel oil in my furnace than prior years. So if that's the kind of cost you're talking about, that's here whether we do anything or not, because this year was a cold year. Mr. Chair, earlier testimony today almost contradicts the need for concern of how much CO2 we're going to emit because of the oil resources we burn, because by 2010 we're not going to, by some accounts, we're not going to have, we're going to have less oil to burn than what we want anyways, and so naturally then all that non-existent oil that runs out isn't going to be there to cause the climate change effects that we're trying to solve right here. So, you know, there's lots of speculation here, and if nothing happens, then this amendment becomes nullified, and if there's no cost, then we don't raise our consumers' prices. So I'd urge a yes vote.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Hilty. And Representative Westrum, as I read the amendment, and I'm looking at this, let's just assume that everybody's going to be held harmless under this bill, but if there was to be a cost under this bill, most likely the cost would be borne by those with the greatest greenhouse gas emissions, so those who pollute the most, and essentially your credit would go to those who pollute. So as I read it, the more you pollute, the more credit you get. So this is an amendment to essentially help the polluters.
Further discussion to the bill? Or to the amendment, rather. Sorry. Representative Western.
I asked for a roll call initially. That still stands, doesn't it, even though we amended the bill? Amendment.
I was assuming that, Representative
right.
Western. I suppose I could have assumed that the amendment was changed and that you hadn't asked for a roll call, but we won't do that. So, roll call having been requested, seeing no further discussion to the amendment, the clerk will take the roll. Chair votes no.
Beard.
Aye.
Lai.
No.
Steiner.
No.
Gardner.
No.
Gunther.
Yes.
Hackbart.
Yes.
Hoppy. Johnson.
No.
Kalen.
You sounded it already.
Knuth.
No.
Magnus. Norna.
Yes.
Osmond. Peterson.
No.
Rude. Saylor.
No.
Slocum. Virginia.
No.
Welty.
No.
Weston.
Yes.
There being 4 ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. There's further amendments?
Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry. 5. There are 5 ayes and 11 nays.
Mr. Chair, we have all we can do to get enough yes votes to begin with.
Sorry about that, Mr. Underwood. It appears that there are no further amendments. Is there further discussion to the bill as amended? Representative Beard.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. You've heard me talk about the carbon tax before, since back in the 1970s when I first became aware of it. And I'm noticing that for one of the few times that I can recall, I actually agree with Representative Chumper, who put out an interesting piece here for us. And he talks about the how we price carbon. If it's a given that carbon is actually a poisonous gas, we are interested in capping or doing something to, that the power of a carbon tax or fee is far better than the trading scheme. I will just point out, and I don't have the chapter and verse in front of me, but one of the reasons Enron Corporation was formed is because in all the hoopla surrounding the original Kyoto business. They saw the cap and trade system coming down the pike, and indeed one of the first visitors after the Kyoto thing was launched for ratification for the nations of the world, one of the first pair of visitors to then President Clinton's office was Mr. Lay and Mr. Skilling, imploring them to bring it up for a Senate vote because they sure wanted a piece of this action of getting in on the ground floor of a carbon cap and trade system. There's a whole lot of money to be made there, and I'm not sure to the author of the bill that it actually will benefit the public, but it's going to benefit somebody, and it's going to do a whole lot of shifting some things around. And I think the power that comes to us is that we actually get to make up the number that constitutes the cap. That's the power that will lie here. A second point I want to make is that just a couple of hours ago we heard a fascinating discussion from a gentleman who's taken a more middle-of-the-road approach, I think, than the first peak oil guy we heard, Mr. Simmons, I believe, who believed that the peak is past and we're about to fall off the cliff. If that's a given, I would say, given the testimony we had just a little bit ago, that we should not be wasting our time at all with a carbon cap or trade, my friend the governor notwithstanding, who has given us more than a few things to be concerned about and disagree with him on, and this is one of them, in my opinion. But if we listen to what Mr. Hughes had to say, he said pretty much burn it up as fast as you can, because when you do, we're going to reach a peak here in the next handful of years, maybe a decade out, and all the carbon dioxide that's released in the air from all the burning we're doing right now will still not reach the peak that the Kyoto Protocol was trying to keep us from reaching when they proposed that back in 1997, which gives us an interesting conundrum here. Why are we doing this when we've got another issue we need to be grappling with, or else the issue with peak oil isn't as severe as we think it is, and I have a hunch that it's probably the thing we should be paying attention to more even than this. Now, the last issue deals with a couple of these things that came up in the Wall Street Journal, and just a little housekeeping. I wish whenever we handed them out, we'd put our name on them. Oh, Joe, you did that? Mr. Chairman, that was our guy. I apologize. That's not to detract from how good they really are.
Maybe this is somebody else who disagrees with that.
No, actually, I agree quite a bit, and I want to make the point that you know how much I love government monkey business. I'm always yelling about it in this committee. I'm going to tell about our friends, the Europeans, where I'm going to remind you again, in 1687, my ancestors fled because they didn't want to be Europeans anymore. They wanted to be Americans. So anyhow, talking about my European cousins, they've been in all kinds of consternation, had two carbon trading schemes going on, and their output has actually risen almost 4% since they put their cap and trade in place. Guess what's happened in the good old USA? Until 2004, we went up only slightly, and since 2005, 2006, and 2007 isn't reported yet, our carbon dioxide output has actually decreased. And there is no carbon cap and trade system in place in the United States. It's just happening, folks, because, like Grandpa used to say, nothing fixes high prices like high prices. And Representative Knuth, you're right. I get tired of paying for gas and electric and heating in my house and cooling it when I don't have to. So I pull the drapes in the summer, or I put that old 3M window film on my windows in the winter. And it works marvelously, and I have a hunch there's probably hundreds of millions of Americans who do the same thing without the government telling them they got to do it. They just do it because it saves money and it's good for business and it's good for our collective pocketbook. I think, members, it's the power of the marketplace at work. It seems to be working in the United States for once, and I don't like to say I told you so, but we're outstripping our European brethren, and they got a masterful command and control system in place. It's not doing nearly as good a job as the United States marketplace is doing. I know that surprises all of you, but I'm pleased just to point it out one more time. So I won't be voting for the bill because I think it's completely unnecessary in the scheme of things, although I'm sure it would put a god of good bureaucrats to work, and that's probably got some merit in there somewhere anyhow. But thank you for considering these, and thank you, Joe, for putting out these Wall Street Journal reports. And when I see Brother Chumper, I'll thank him for this little piece, too. It's a pretty good piece.
Well, Representative Beard, it might surprise you to hear that I actually agree with you about the carbon tax issue. I think that if we totally redid our revenue system that was based on the carbon tax, that would make a lot more sense. But say about
my friend David Hughes, but I really don't think he was advocating burning up fossil fuel resources that we have as fast as possible. And I think that one of the points that he made in his presentation actually is that the reason that carbon emissions have been held steady or reduced in North America is because we have exported all of the carbon-emitting jobs to other parts of the world. But since it is just one planet, I don't think we have really thereby reduced carbon emissions. We have just been able to blame it on somebody else.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's a whole other chapter of the carbon cap and trade business that we would need to talk about.
Agenda is getting kind of complex, but I'm really looking forward to it.
I will point out that the adult beverage, Mr. Chairman, we're speaking of using to help us with our discussions, emits an awful lot of carbon dioxide from time to time, too. So.
I can't argue with that. Further discussion to the bill. Representative West.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to clarify, I don't think those jobs you're referring to did go to Europe, which is where Representative Beard was referring to.
Representative Western, that would kind of be my point. I think the reason that that Europe hasn't achieved the same degree of reductions that we have is that they haven't been exporting all of their jobs to China and India.
I see. Well, Mr. Chair, I'll roll call the bill. So, ask for a roll call on the final passage whenever we get to that.
Very well. Is there further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Westrom, I guess we're going to take your roll call.
But, Mr. Chair, is there any testifiers in the audience that have concern about this bill? Or
I'm sorry, it's getting late, and I neglected to ask. Thank you for reminding me. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Representative Westrom? We see no one coming forward.
I suppose, Mr. Chair, the ones we're hoisting it on, they get to pass it through the PUC anyways, and the rest are happy with it.
Well, Representative Wester, I would remind you that what this bill suggests is just some principles to be followed if this is going to go forward. It isn't putting anything about an actual agreement into law. It's merely suggesting some of the things that should be considered. I think that
there's
a long way to go before anything concrete would actually come out of it.
Mr. Chair, and I'll be quiet after this, my concern, and I think the people's concern should be, you don't have a partner to dance with. Just by standing in the middle of the floor, you always have to have a few steps to get the courage up to ask her to dance and then to get over there and get her out to dance. So, Mr. Chair, this is just stepping it up to getting her to walk out on the dance floor with you, and we're getting pretty close to the dance. So I think we know how incrementalism works around here, and to be certain with her right now is probably a little closer than we want to be. So.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if Representative Western knows, but I do actually have a dance club. We might need to invite you along next time.
Mr. Chair, for the record,
Representative Western,
I wasn't referring to her as Representative Kennedy.
Thank you, Representative Western, for that clarification.
Mr. Chair, should we remind Representative Westrom that I believe that Director Garvey is actually in negotiations right now, and he may be doing the invitation.
Seeing no further discussion to the bill and the roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll. I should first say that Representative Knuth renews her motion that House File 3195, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. The chair votes aye.
Beard.
Nay.
Bly.
Aye.
Finer.
Aye.
Gardner.
Aye.
Spencer.
Nay.
Hackbar.
No.
Happy. Johnson.
Yes.
Taylor.
Aye.
Canoes.
Yes.
Magnus. Norna.
No.
Osment.
Yes.
Peterson.
Yes.
Rude. Taylor.
Yes.
Slocum. Virginia.
Yes.
Welty.
Yes.
Westrom.
No.
There being 12 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. The amendment, or the bill, is passed. So with that, members, we will be meeting on Monday or Wednesday to take up a few more bills and hopefully to be able to act on our finance bill. And with that, members, the meeting is adjourned.